Reports of potential wrongdoing at the Trump Foundation. Meanwhile, Trump himself has a common theme in his campaign speeches, needling the media.
With thousands of people outside, I challenge those cameras to show this arena packed. They never do. They never do.
It's Wednesday, September 14th. This is All Things Considered. Our story coming up. Good afternoon, I'm Lisa Mullins. Also ahead, the Department of Veterans Affairs spends billions each year to help wounded warriors, but it's not a blank check.
At some point, Congress and the President over the years have made a judgment about how generous they want that compensation system to be.
Where this leaves the vet, coming up. More employers are moving their workers to high-deductible health plans to save money. And Bay Staters who figured out how to compete in running and sailing despite physical disability. These stories and much more still to come. The time now is 1:04, and news headlines from NPR are next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Donald Trump has taped an interview about his medical history with controversial celebrity Dr. Mehmet Oz. NPR's Jessica Taylor reports that in the episode set to air tomorrow, the two review the results of the GOP presidential nominee's physical examination last week.
According to a statement from the Dr. Oz show, the 70-year-old candidate discussed his cardiovascular health, prostate health, family medical history, and more. In an unusual letter last year, Trump's doctor had proclaimed he would be the, quote, healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency. Press were not allowed inside the taping, but some audience members told NBC News afterwards that Dr. Oz told Trump he had good lab results, including his blood pressure and cholesterol. He is slightly overweight, though, reportedly at 267 pounds. Trump admitted he doesn't exercise much and said campaigning is his form of physical activity, and he doubled down on his affinity for fast food. Jessica Taylor, NPR News, Washington.
Hillary Clinton is still recovering from pneumonia. If she returns to campaigning tomorrow as planned, the Democratic presidential nominee faces the task of winning over voters who have been concerned about her ability to be straight with them. President Obama's former senior advisor David Axelrod spoke to NPR's Morning Edition about the challenge Clinton faces over transparency in the wake of controversy over handling of classified information when she was Secretary of State.
I don't think health is as big a challenge for her as stealth. She is a relentless, indefatigable person. I can attest to that. But the concerns that people have run to the other thing, and they ended up creating this a bigger story than the one they were trying to avoid.
President Obama says the U.S. is ready to lift economic sanctions on Myanmar as that country continues its transition to democratic rule. NPR's Scott Horsley says Obama announced the move after a White House meeting with Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi.
President Obama says reforms in Myanmar are not complete, but have moved more quickly than many people expected. Aung San Suu Kyi has gone from being a prisoner under house arrest to a key figure in an elected parliament. So Obama says it's appropriate to lift the remaining U.S. economic sanctions and reward the country, also known as Burma, with favorable trading status.
It is the right thing to do in order to ensure that the people of Burma see rewards from a new way of doing business and a new government.
The U.S. is still concerned about the outsized role the military plays in Myanmar, as well as that country's treatment of ethnic and religious minorities. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
Meanwhile, the Obama administration plans to take in 110,000 refugees from around the world starting in the new fiscal year that begins October 1st. That is nearly 30% more than the number admitted in the previous year. Before the close, Dow was down 32 at 18,034. This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. The attorney for Gloucester's police chief says an internal investigation into Chief Leonard Campanello has nothing to do with his public duties. Gloucester's mayor says the chief is on indefinite leave. He did not disclose, though, what caused the investigation. Campanello's attorney says he will cooperate, and he's confident he'll return to his position. Campanello has received national attention for his innovative program called the Angel Initiative. It'll continue in his absence. The program allows people to turn in their drugs without facing criminal charge in exchange for treatment. The police chief in Methuen is urging a Lawrence man to turn himself in to face charges that he killed his girlfriend. Emilio De La Rosa is accused of murdering Wanda Rosa in her Methuen apartment Monday morning. Chief Joseph Solomon describes the search for De La Rosa as active.
We've spent an enormous amount of time searching for him, and I think it only behooves him to turn himself in and move forward with legal representation and see what the courts have to say.
Police say De La Rosa threatened to kill Rosa for years. He was released in January after being sentenced to 4 years in prison for attacking her. Hundreds of elderly patients on Cape Cod are looking for new doctors after a house call program announced it's going to close its doors. The Hope Health Home Care Program sent doctors to the homes of about 200 patients it has for the past 4 years. The company's CEO says low insurance payments and high travel times made it impossible to see enough patients to make a profit. And state election officials today are reporting low but not unexpected turnout from last week's primary elections. The Secretary of State's office says just under 9% of voters went to the polls last Thursday. That was about what they had expected. In the forecast, overnight tonight, you should have some thunderstorms, possibly some downed limbs and branches. Look out for those. Temperatures about 60. Back to the sunshine tomorrow. Should be dry and sunny once again. A little on the cool side with highs just about 70 degrees. This is WBUR at 6 past 4.
Funding for WBUR weather reports comes from Charles River Apparel, founders of the original New Englander rain jacket, and now apparel for every season. The 2017 collection is at charlesriverapparel.com. Other supporters include ADP, committed to helping businesses build better, more productive workforces with payroll and HR solutions that combine software with human insights and expertise. ADP, a more human resource. More at ADP.com.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Kelly McEvers. We're starting off this hour with the investigation into the Donald J. Trump Foundation. The Trump campaign calls the investigation by New York's Attorney General a left-wing hit job. Here's NPR's Joel Rose.
New York's Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says he first contacted the Trump Foundation back in June.
Charities have to follow the rules. You can't give money to a political campaign.
That's Schneiderman earlier today on CBS This Morning. Schneiderman says he was investigating reports that Trump's foundation gave money to the Political Action Committee of Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi. That's a clear violation of IRS rules, and the Trump Foundation paid a penalty for it. Schneiderman says that's where his investigation began.
There were allegations that they'd made contributions to political committees, which is illegal. I'm just following the rules that I do with any other charity. We never had a press conference. We never did any grandstanding on this. This is just me doing my job.
Trump's campaign doesn't see it that way. In a statement, a spokesman blasted Schneiderman, a Democrat who's endorsed Hillary Clinton, as a, quote, partisan hack who is simply trying to distract from a bad week for the Clinton campaign. Schneiderman and Trump are not exactly strangers. Schneiderman is already suing the GOP nominee over alleged fraud at his Trump University. Even people who like Schneiderman say he can come off as opportunistic.
One of the most dangerous places in New York is between Mr. Schneiderman and a microphone.
James Fishman is a former prosecutor in the New York Attorney General's office and taught law at Pace University. But that said, Fishman thinks there are potential problems with the way the Trump Foundation is run.
Carelessness, sloppiness, ignorance of either the spirit or the substance of rules.
An investigation by the Washington Post found that Trump Foundation funds were used for some questionable purchases. A football helmet autographed by Tim Tebow that Trump won at a charity auction for $12,000, and a life-sized painting of Donald Trump that his wife won at another charity auction for $20,000. The Post also learned that Trump himself gave no money to his own foundation after 2008. Instead, it takes donations from others and passes them on to charitable causes. Leslie Lankowski teaches philanthropic studies at Indiana University.
When a person gets money from a foundation, they think often that the money is actually that of the person after whom the foundation is named. That certainly isn't true for the Trump Foundation.
Lankowski notes that the foundations of many celebrities and athletes work much the same way, and he says that's not likely to be a legal problem for the Trump Foundation. But it might be an optical problem. Trump talks about giving his own money to charity anonymously. Here he is in an interview with ABC from June.
I give a lot of money to charity. Over a period of years, I've given over $100 million to charity.
But Trump has not given any proof for that claim. He could release his tax returns, which would show what he's given to charity, but Trump is the only presidential candidate in the last 40 years not to release his returns. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
Presidential candidates deliver hundreds of stump speeches over the course of their campaigns. And this week, we're listening closely to the messages that the two major party candidates deliver in city after city. Yesterday, we heard Hillary Clinton. Today, it's Donald Trump. NPR's Sarah McCammon has heard many, many of his speeches as she follows his campaign, and she's with us now. Hi there.
Hey, Kelly.
Donald Trump tends to deliver his stump speeches at these big rallies and these big arenas. Just tell us what that's like.
You know, Kelly, they're all pretty similar. I mean, early in the campaign, he used to be really freeform and never speak from a script. He's been more scripted lately, but, you know, just about every stump speech hits some of the same major themes. We're going to listen now to parts of a speech that Trump gave late last week in Pensacola, Florida. Now, there's always a rotating playlist of very loud music at these rallies. This one opened up with the country song, God Bless the USA.
This is a crowd. There are thousands of people outside that can't get in. Fantastic. Way to go. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
So, Kelly, that was true in this case. There was a big, long line of people who couldn't get in. But Trump tends to say this regardless of the size of the crowd. He pumps them up by telling them that they're part of a movement. And there's a consistent way in which he tries to demonstrate that.
Polls came out today where we're up in Ohio, we're up in Florida, we're up in North Carolina, up. We're up nationwide. CNN 2 days ago, up nationwide.
Okay, so Donald Trump just cited a CNN poll there, but we also often hear him spending a lot of time during his stump speeches actually attacking the media, right?
Right. At just about every rally, he points back to the reporters gathered at the back of the room and calls them dishonest. And, you know, again, he's working with the people in the crowd here who almost always turn around and boo.
And with thousands of people outside, I challenge those cameras to show this arena packed. They never do. They never do. They never, ever do.
Now, the truth is a lot of crowd photos are taken by the media at Trump rallies because the crowd is just such a huge part of the story.
Okay, so whipping up the crowd, that's clearly a thing that he does at these stump speeches. When he does start talking about substance, what is his message?
So his attacks on the media are kicking off an indictment of something bigger, what he calls the rigged system. He says the establishment, so the government, the mainstream media, have created rules and institutions that are hurting average Americans.
All the people who've rigged the system, and we have had a rigged system, for their own personal benefit, are trying to stop our change campaign because they know that their gravy train has reached its last stop.
And it doesn't take long before Trump lands this message right on his opponent.
It's been happening long enough. And the reason they don't do anything about it is because the special interests and the donors control our politicians, and they control Hillary Clinton.
Does Trump lay out how exactly he thinks the special interests and the donors have controlled politicians?
He doesn't say quite how, but he walks through all the things he says have gone wrong because of people, he says, like Hillary Clinton. You know, her handling of the attack on a U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya, and the private email system she kept while Secretary of State.
Hillary Clinton has presided over the greatest series of and you know this, I mean, the greatest series that I've ever seen of foreign policy failures and mistakes and blunders that anyone has ever seen. Everything she touches has turned bad. Now she wants to be president. I mean, the only thing she's done well, and she'll go down in history for it, I have to admit, is getting out of trouble with the emails. That's the single greatest achievement of Hillary Clinton. True.
And you can hear the crowd chanting, lock her up there. So that is Donald Trump's case against Hillary Clinton. How does he lay out his own agenda?
So there are a couple of key issues he always mentions in really every stump speech. Let's hear that.
We're going to pursue new trade policies that put American workers first. And we're going to keep our jobs in our country.
So he's promised to cut better trade deals, even renegotiate existing deals like NAFTA. And then, of course, there's the issue that's been the core of his campaign.
We will also have a very, very strong border. that stops people and drugs. And those drugs are poisoning our youth and poisoning our people from illegally pouring into our country. And we will build the wall, and Mexico will pay for the wall.
Building this wall, of course, has been Trump's biggest, most consistent promise of this campaign. Is it also, you know, during these speeches, is it the biggest moment?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of big moments. It's not just the wall. It's his promise to build up the military, to be tough on our adversaries. And all these lines in Trump's speech feed into the iconic idea of his campaign.
We will be strong. We will be safe. We will win again. Ladies and gentlemen, we will make America great again. Thank you very much. God bless you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.
And often Trump closes his rallies with this Rolling Stones song, "You Can't Always Get What You Want," which matches the kind of defiant tone of his speeches.
It's NPR Sarah McCammon. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can't always get what you want.
This is WBUR's All Things Considered. I'm Lisa Mullins. There are no major contested races for statewide office in this fall's ballot, and that gives people like Governor Charlie Baker and Senator Elizabeth Warren a breather. But 2 years down the road, in the 2018 election, both the governor and the senator are expected to run for re-election. The president of Mass Inc. Polling Group, WBUR analyst Steve Casella, has released new poll numbers today, and a look at the results tell him that neither Warren nor Baker should rest on their laurels. Here's his take.
Governor Charlie Baker and Senator Elizabeth Warren are a popular pair. So at this early moment, what are the prospects of a real contest for either office in the 2018 election? If very recent history is any guide, nobody should take anything for granted. Baker has consistently held extremely high poll numbers on pretty much every measure since taking office. The new WBUR poll shows he still walks on water. 62% of Massachusetts voters give him a favorable rating, compared to just 16% unfavorable. For the last few years, national polls comparing him to other governors have often found him one of the two most popular governors in America. Senator Elizabeth Warren's numbers are not quite as high as Baker's, but still look strong. She is viewed favorably by 53% of voters and unfavorably by 36%, and she has routinely drawn positive reviews throughout her nearly 4 years in the Senate. Both Warren and Baker are political juggernauts right now, but as two recent elections have shown, much can change in 2 years. Former Senator Scott Brown was once the state's most popular politician. As late as the summer of 2011, he faced no credible opposition and seemed the overwhelming favorite to easily win re-election. But then Elizabeth Warren appeared on the scene, took the Democratic nomination, and beat Brown by 8 points in their 2012 matchup. More evidence that polls taken months and years ahead can change in a big way comes from former Governor Deval Patrick's re-election bid. In February of 2010, the year he ran for re-election, a Suffolk University poll found just 35% of Massachusetts voters approved of his performance, and only 29% thought he deserved another term. However, he turned his numbers around by fall and won re-election handily. Of course, unseating Elizabeth Warren would require the Massachusetts Republican Party to recruit a qualified and appealing candidate, which has been a struggle in recent years. And the Democrats would have to find someone willing to take on Baker, one of the nation's most popular governors. But with this long to go until 2018, nobody is invincible, no matter how high their poll numbers are right now.
Analyst Steve Casella is president of Mass Inc. Polling Group, which conducts political research for WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Vertex, helping develop the next generation of scientific leaders through STEM education programs for high school students in Boston. VRTX.com. And Wheelworks, dedicated to helping you discover autumn in New England on two wheels, pedal-powered and electric-assist bicycles, accessories, and more. Wheelworks.com.
Massachusetts Paralympians coming up in just a couple of minutes on WBUR. Checking business, stocks closed mostly lower today. The Dow was down about 0.2% or 32 points to finish the session at 18,035. S&P was down a small fraction. It finished the day at 21.26, and the NASDAQ managed a small gain of about 0.3%. It closed today at 51.71. It's 19 past 4.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Brilliant Earth. Conflict-free diamond engagement rings, wedding rings, and fine jewelry online at BrilliantEarth.com and their new Newbury Street showroom. Appointments available now. And EasyPass, the electronic toll collection program. Visit EasyPassMA.com to sign up and get a free transponder. EasyPass, it's free and easy.
84 degrees now, could have some more showers or thunderstorms overnight. Tonight, strong winds, too. Temperatures about 60 tonight. Tomorrow, sunny, dry, and cooler. Should top out at 70 degrees. 84 degrees. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Stitch Fix, an online personal styling service where hand-selected clothing is delivered to the customer's home. Customers can keep what they love and send back the rest. Learn more at stitchfix.com. And Carbonite, an automatic cloud backup service for protecting and recovering digital photos, documents, and other files from anywhere. Learn more at carbonite.com.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Kelly McEvers. Give Edward Snowden a pardon. That is what a group of human rights organizations are calling on President Obama to do. Activists and lawyers held a news conference today to kick off a campaign to support Snowden. The former National Security Agency contractor fled the country 3 years ago with a trove of top secret data from the National Security Agency. While Snowden's revelations have sparked outrage and reforms, the government still wants him tried under the Espionage Act. NPR's David Wellner reports on today's news conference.
Human Rights Watch was there. Amnesty International was there. So was Anthony Romero, who directs the American Civil Liberties Union. He told reporters in New York that Edward Snowden had acted patriotically, responsibly, and with courage, and deserves a presidential pardon.
We're not arguing that Edward Snowden did not break the law. The pardon power exists for people who did break the law, but where there are mitigating circumstances that outweigh the case for punishment.
Romero argued that by leaking to just a few reporters the details of the NSA's previously unknown collection of Americans' phone data, Snowden had acted as a whistleblower and had done so purely in the public interest.
A pardon for Edward Snowden would be good for America and would help burnish the president's legacy as one of the primary defenders of human rights. Pardoning Snowden would be a powerful way for the president to acknowledge that the government did wrong, kept us in the dark, acted unconstitutionally. And but for the actions of Edward Snowden, we would still be in a very dark place.
Snowden himself appeared at the news conference via video link from Russia, where he's been living in exile for more than 3 years. He thanked the activists for pressing for a pardon, but did not specifically ask for one himself.
The question of whether I, as a whistleblower, should be pardoned is not for me to answer. But I will say this. I love my country. I love my family. And I have dedicated my life to both of them.
If he returns to the U.S., Snowden could face up to 30 years in prison. But he said he could not get a fair trial under the World War I era Espionage Act, since it would not recognize what he maintained were his actions as a whistleblower.
My concern here is not just myself. If I and other whistleblowers are sentenced to long years in prison without so much as a chance to explain our motivations to a jury, it will have a deeply chilling effect on future whistleblowers working as I did to expose government abuse and overreach. It will chill speech. It will corrode the quality of our democracy.
Even some of Snowden's critics say he touched off a necessary public examination of the NSA's practices. Here's former Obama administration Attorney General Eric Holder in May on the podcast The Axe Files.
I think that he actually performed a public service by raising the debate that we engaged in and by the changes that that we made.
But when asked this week about a pardon for Snowden, White House spokesman Josh Earnest gave no indication one might be in the works.
There's a process that people can go through in requesting a pardon. But right now, Mr. Snowden has not been convicted of crimes with regard to this particular situation, but he's charged with serious crimes. And it's the view of the administration and certainly the view of the president that he should return to the United States and face those charges.
Snowden supporters hope a new Oliver Stone biopic titled Snowden coming out this week will help build pressure for a pardon. And what does Snowden himself think?
I think the most important impact of the film will be to reach a new audience on the topic of actually the issues that matter the most.
Meanwhile, Snowden's visa in Russia will expire in August. David Wellner, NPR News.
This is WBUR's All Things Considered. I'm Lisa Mullins. There are some 300 athletes from the United States competing this week in the Paralympic Games in Rio. Four of them are Massachusetts natives. We spoke with two of those, a sailor from Marblehead and a runner from Grafton.
My name's Chaz Davis, and I'm part of the Team USA Paralympic track team.
Chaz Davis is 22. 3 years ago, he was a freshman at the University of Hartford, running on the track and cross-country teams. He had a crushing medical setback.
One day in March, I woke up and my right eye, I could really not see too much out of it at all.
It happened so suddenly. Doctors didn't know what was wrong. It wasn't until several months later that doctors determined he had a disorder that attacks the eye's optic nerve and makes it atrophy. Davis soon lost vision in his left eye, too. He was declared legally blind.
Primarily, I see shadows, shapes, and just a whole blur of colors, really. When I first did lose my sight, it was devastating, as, you know, many people would probably realize.
He fell into a deep depression.
I really had no clue where I was going to go. I kind of felt the world was against me and everything was against me, and it would be really hard to move forward.
When Davis was first diagnosed, a doctor told him not to run or exercise at all. It wasn't clear if exertion could further impair what little vision he had left.
And running has always been such a huge part of my life, you know, emotionally, even prior to losing my sight. It has always really been that outlet.
He took the whole summer off. He sat in his bedroom most of the time. He gained 40 pounds. And then he saw a specialist who said that running might help by revitalizing cells. So Davis learned how to run without seeing, how not to fly off the back of a treadmill, how to follow the fuzzy white lines he can just make out on the track. His college teammates rallied around him. He started running on the open road, with them acting as his guides.
So they'll run maybe a step in front of me or side by side where I can see them out of my peripheral vision, because though my entire field of vision is affected, my peripheral vision is most intact. I can have a constant dialogue with them while I run to call out certain obstacles, whether potholes or sticks, those kind of things, so we can maneuver around that.
Chaz Davis started competing again. He became the fastest person on his team, faster than when he had perfect vision. He isn't the only Bay Stater competing in Rio who had to relearn a sport.
My name is Maureen McKinnon. I'm from Marblehead, Mass., and I am here at the Paralympics for the two-person discipline in sailing.
Maureen McKinnon is 51. She became a paraplegic in 1995.
I was right next to an ocean seawall, and I happened to trip on an unfortunate rope that was in front of me. I did not see over the wall and down 13 feet, sitting in a landing in a sitting position, and breaking my lumbar one and giving me an incomplete spinal cord injury from the waist down.
It didn't stop her from going back to competitive sailing. She tried different boats and found one that was a perfect fit, the Scud 18, which is made for people with disabilities. In 2008, 13 years after she became a paraplegic, McKinnon qualified for the Paralympics in Beijing. She and her sailing partner won gold. Her teammate had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and died not long after the Games. McKinnon's new skipper is a college student from California who became a quadriplegic in a diving accident a few years ago. What does it mean to you specifically to be competing in your second Paralympic Games? And are you looking to other people to kind of take notice to what you're doing?
I would prefer that they take notice of disabled sailing as a whole, because I feel as though the sport is very empowering for people with disabilities. We are able to sail leaving our wheelchairs at the dock, and we're free to go about the ocean as we wish. For me, the honor is really to represent my country for a second time and to hopefully bring home some type of bling around my neck.
Some kind of bling.
Of any color.
Of any color. You're not so choosy, are you?
Well, now that I have a gold, you know, a full set would be nice.
Maureen McKinnon's fellow Bay Stater in Rio, the legally blind runner Chaz Davis, says even if he doesn't medal, competing in the Games will be his personal victory.
I'm really just doing this more so for me, because it's something that I needed to do to get myself back on track and move on with my life and move on from this blindness and not let that define me. You know, because there's a lot more to me than just being blind or having a visual impairment. So really taking that leap of faith got me to the point of making it as far as I have.
So here's the update on the games. Chaz Davis came in 10th in the 1,500-meter race. That's a personal best for him. Tomorrow morning, he's going to compete in the 5,000-meter race at 9 o'clock Eastern time. Maureen McKinnon will be sailing every day until medals are awarded on Saturday. She and her sailing partner are in 6th place out of 10 pairs in their class. If you'd like to see more on them and the two other Paralympians from Massachusetts, as well as a link to the Team USA live coverage from Rio, go to WBUR.org.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Neighborhood Health Plan, providing world-class doctors, hospitals, and helpfulness. Because Neighborhood values what you value. Learn more at nhpvalues.org. Sugarbush Resort, 2 mountains and 2,000 acres of backcountry skiing, 3 hours from Boston. Early season passes available until midnight at sugarbush.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning dentists and patients short implants, avoiding the need for many surgical bone grafting procedures. 617-524-3900.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The biggest organization in the Clinton Foundation says it will strike out on its own if Hillary Clinton is elected president. NPR's Peter Overby tells us the Clinton Health Access Initiative has been a leader in distributing drugs to fight HIV/AIDS.
The Clinton Health Access Initiative, or CHAI for short, has a board dominated by Bill and Chelsea Clinton and old Clinton allies. They'll all be leaving if Hillary Clinton becomes president. Longtime Clinton associate Ira Magaziner would remain as CHAI's CEO, but CHAI would cut its ties to the Clinton Foundation. The announcement comes a month after the foundation said it would shrink its size and focus, again, if Hillary Clinton wins in November. The health initiative is the biggest component of the Clinton Foundation. It says it currently operates in 33 countries with 1,500 staff worldwide. Hillary Clinton has repeatedly come under criticism for her connections to foundation donors and for possible conflicts of interest. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
President Obama says lifting economic sanctions against Myanmar will help the country, also known as Burma, reap the benefits of its transition to democracy.
It is the right thing to do in order to ensure that the people of Burma see rewards from a new way of doing business and a new government.
Obama met today with the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, at the Oval Office. The announcement comes as she makes her first visit to Washington since assuming her leadership role in November. New Mexico Senator says Facebook has picked his state over Utah for a new data center. Senator Martin Heinrich says the social media giant will build in Los Lunas, south of Albuquerque. Los Lunas agreed to give up all property taxes for 30 years in exchange for annual payments from Facebook. Facebook also provides funding for NPR. Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Lisa Mullins. The Norfolk County District Attorney has dropped charges in 6 prosecutions because of missing evidence at the Braintree Police Department. WBUR's Fred Tice reports.
One defendant was charged with trafficking in opiates, possession to distribute cocaine, and identity fraud. Charges against him were dropped Monday. Attorney Michael Bennett says his client spent a year in jail because he could not raise bail.
There should be checks and balances in place that would prevent any single rogue officer or group of officers from doing this sort of thing. There should be periodic internal audits.
This spring, the Braintree Police Chief commissioned an audit of his department's evidence room. The officer in charge of the evidence room committed suicide shortly thereafter. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Fred Tice.
Today, the city of Worcester began buying water from the Massachusetts Water Resources Authority to supplement its own drinking water supply. Worcester is in a Stage 3 drought, banning residents from non-critical water use, including watering lawns and washing cars. Phil Guerin is the city's director of water and sewer operations. He says they'll start taking measures to ensure residents aren't wasting water.
We haven't fined anyone as of yet, but we do have that authority, and we're at the point now where we will likely be exercising that in the coming weeks.
The fines will start at $200. Boston Light, the country's oldest lighthouse, is being honored today as it turns 300 years old. During a celebration along the waterfront, the head of the Coast Guard in Boston called it a landmark that'll stand the test of time. Mayor Marty Walsh says it'll always remain a national treasure. The lighthouse on Little Brewster Island in Boston Harbor was built by the British in 1716. It was destroyed during the the American Revolution and rebuilt in 1783. Thousands of Bruce Springsteen fans are making their way to Foxborough this afternoon for the final concert of the summer season at Gillette Stadium. It's also the final stop on the Boss's National River Tour. Springsteen and the E Street Band last performed in Foxborough 4 years ago. It's 4:34.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Children's Hospital, where the greatest children's stories come to life. Joys, milestones, life-changing moments. Learn about kids who inspire caregivers to keep working until every child is well. Boston Children's, ranked U.S. News & World Report's number one pediatric hospital. BostonChildrens.org/greatest stories.
Showers moving out, temperatures about 60 tonight. Then for tomorrow, only making it to about 70 despite lots of sunshine tomorrow. 84 degrees in the Boston area at 4:35.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from ADT Security, helping to protect families and homes for over 140 years. Learn more at ADT.com. And Moo, working to help businesses big and small create a unique paper version of themselves with premium business cards, postcards, and stickers. This is You by Moo. Learn more at Moo.com.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Kelly McEvers. The state of North Carolina got some more bad news today. The Atlantic Coast Conference says most of its postseason collegiate tournaments will not be played in the state. And the reason? North Carolina's new state law that removes some protections for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. We are joined now by reporter Jeff Tiberi from member station WUNC. Hello there.
Hey there.
And so the NCAA announced something similar a few days ago. I mean, how big of a deal is today's decision?
So this announcement from the ACC hits closer to home. The conference is based here in North Carolina, and there have been a number of out-of-state businesses and entities like NCAA that have said they won't expand here, or entertainers who have canceled concerts. The NBA back in July pulled its All-Star game out of Charlotte. But this is a hometown organization that is essentially saying what the legislature passed back in March, it just doesn't agree with. As a reminder, House Bill 2 is this piece of legislation. It was hastily passed, and its most controversial provision is one that requires people to use the bathroom that corresponds to the sex listed on their birth certificate. Right. Now, Republicans defend it as a safety measure, and Democrats say that it's simply discriminatory.
And so what are people there saying about the ACC's decision to move some of these tournaments out of North Carolina?
I would say, Kelly, so far, pushback has been less than what we heard following the NCAA's decision a few days ago. People, I think, are still feeling that blow. Certainly, there has been reaction today not as strong. North Carolina House Speaker said today that the ACC and the NCAA are entitled to do what they want, but reiterated that the law in question is one that's designed to protect people. Yesterday, the governor, he has not issued a statement yet today. The governor of North Carolina, Pat McCrory, railed against the NCAA and said that the law should be fought over in the courts and not with sporting events.
I think it's important to say there is money attached to these championships. I mean, how much will this decision by the ACC hurt North Carolina financially?
It's tough to know precisely. Here's what we do know. The ACC football championship was slated to take place in Charlotte the first Saturday in December. That would have brought as much as $35 million to that city. It's now moving elsewhere. Not just football, though. Men's and women's diving, that was going to be held in Greensboro. That's a loss of about $1 million economic impact. That city was also scheduled to host the ACC women's basketball tournament worth more than $5 million to the city. Also, other sports that will be played at the championships out of North Carolina, field hockey, swimming, golf, baseball. So it adds up, and this is another blow for the state.
Is it more than just a financial loss? I mean, is it another domino falling? Does it get even bigger than that?
Yeah, it is. It does. And you know, what's different, again, is that the fact that the ACC Atlantic Coast Conference is based in Greensboro, North Carolina. It was founded here more than 60 years ago. For many of the other companies that said they would not expand in the state or performers who canceled those concerts, local and state officials just called those entities radical organizations with liberal agendas, and they didn't understand what North Carolina was about, what this law was about. But here you have this hometown entity who are saying the same things as all of these terrible organizations, according to Republicans from other parts of the country. So this is going to be harder for many of them to criticize. And we should note that a lot of these state lawmakers graduated from some of these ACC schools that are now taking a stand against this controversial new law.
That's Jeff Tiberi of member station WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
More than 40,000 charities across the country are set up to help military veterans. The charities provide wheelchairs, service dogs, alternative medicine, even new homes. But the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs spends a lot of money taking care of vets, and it's asking Congress for $180 billion next year. So NPR's Quil Lawrence set out to learn why veterans even need these charities.
If anyone gets a full ride from the VA, you'd expect it to be Vishnu Gonzalez. He went to Iraq twice as a U.S. Marine. The invasion in 2003 was easy compared to his second tour in Fallujah.
That was chaotic. That was just a firefight every day.
That tour cost him. A sniper shot him in the spine, leaving him paralyzed from the chest down. Normally, he gets around on a motorized wheelchair. Right now, he's laid up with pressure sores, which he's trying not to get depressed about.
I'm okay. I'm fine. I don't think too much about that because then I'll go crazy.
And he's pretty well set up. He takes courses online. He lives with his wife and his mom in New Jersey. They've got a fully wheelchair-accessible house, a lift for his van. In the garage are four wheelchairs, two electric, two manual. But the VA paid for almost none of that.
This was gifted by Friends of Westchester Hills, but through Independence Fund.
Gonzalez's mother, Maria Elena Baez, is his full-time caregiver.
I'm going to talk to you while this call comes on.
Yeah, okay? Of course.
The whole time I visited, she was on hold, working through red tape. And this is more than a decade after Vishnu was shot.
Hi, Kayla. I am calling on behalf of my son, Corporal Vishnu Gonzalez.
Sitting in his garage is one very nice electric wheelchair from the VA. But the all-terrain chair and the one that can rise up to eye level and even climb stairs, the VA won't always foot the bill for that kind of thing, says Phil Carter with the Center for a New American Security.
The statutes and regulations for the VA essentially make those judgments about the line between what's necessary or even, in some cases, what's good and what is extravagant.
Carter is an Iraq vet and has advised the Hillary Clinton campaign on vets' issues. He says VA was never supposed to be a blank check, more like a special kind of workman's comp.
And at some point, Congress and the president over the years have made a judgment about how generous they want that compensation system to be.
Carter says charities step up to fill the gaps, not always perfectly, not always with the exact right focus, but well enough. Carter co-authored a study of veterans' charities called Charting the Sea of Goodwill. What he found worried him.
There's been no post-9/11 surge in giving to veterans' causes, no surge around the time of the Iraq War, no surge around the time of the Walter Reed scandal. The revenue trend in the sector has been completely flat.
It might be that people just assume the VA has veterans covered. Carter says much of the giving comes from traditional veterans' organizations, and their membership is getting older. Whatever the reason, the concern for vets you hear from politicians and at football games and on social media isn't matched with dollars, Carter says. And that's bad news for Vishnu Gonzalez and his family.
Cooking.
They're fine right now. Something delicious is simmering in the kitchen, and his mom has just gotten off the phone after hours trying to get a medical issue fixed.
And it wasn't resolved.
It wasn't resolved. How many hours a day do you spend on the phone?
Oh, a lot.
Before this, she owned a real estate company. She was a successful businesswoman. Now she's his full-time caregiver with a modest stipend from the VA. Vishnu Gonzalez is 33 and hoping to start a family soon. His mother, Maria Elena, knows he's going to be needing help for decades to come.
This is a miracle, and this is a survival story. And I know there are many other guys that are not so lucky to have what my son has. But definitely our lives changed drastically to the worst. You know, we're making out the best of what we've been given.
The VA will take care of the basics. But to have a good life, Maria Elena says she'll probably always need what's given by what she calls the beautiful people in nonprofits and charities. With veterans' needs increasing, that giving might not keep up. Quil Lawrence, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The cost of health insurance keeps rising. One way companies can minimize the damage to their bottom lines is by offering employees health insurance with high deductibles, $1,000 or more. A new survey shows more employers are doing that. It comes from the Kaiser Family Foundation, which also supports coverage of health on NPR. NPR's Allison Kojak has more on the survey.
Covenant Care provides hospice and palliative care to people in Florida and Alabama. A couple of years ago, the company switched most of its 600 workers from traditional health insurance to a high-deductible health plan. Pat Holtman is Senior Manager of Human Resources.
At Covenant, we pay 80% of the cost of the plan, and even at that point, you know, there's some business decisions that need to be made regarding what we can't afford to do.
The company puts cash into employee accounts to help workers meet their deductibles. And if employees participate in wellness programs, they get points to pay even more of the cost.
If they go online and do a wellness assessment, they can accrue points that way. If they're non-tobacco users, there are a certain number of points that are accrued there.
Shifting more of the burden to their employees is something a growing number of companies, large and small, are doing to cut healthcare costs. The Kaiser survey shows that more than half of workers now have health plans with deductibles of $1,000 or more. Kaiser President Drew Altman says companies like Covenant are getting creative.
Your typical employer is using everything in the toolkit to control their premiums.
They use those wellness programs. They also try to help workers manage their chronic illnesses. But
if you want to bring down the premium increase quickly in any given year, the immediate step you can take is to increase deductibles or other forms of cost sharing.
And that's redefining health insurance.
There's been a gradual sea change in what insurance is for most Americans, from more comprehensive coverage to skimpier coverage.
The study shows that a family health plan costs companies and workers together about $18,000. By raising deductibles from $200 to $1,000, employers can lop about 20% off that bill, says Dave Anderson. He's the CEO of Health Now, which runs Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Western New York. Anderson says companies do think hard before they bump up deductibles because employees don't like it.
I would say no one goes there lightly. Many employers have just felt like they had to go in that direction because they had to fix premium costs in some way.
His company offers its own employees a high-deductible plan. And like Covenant in Florida, it encourages its workers to participate in wellness programs to knock down their share of the cost. The company will pay half the deductible for people who do a health risk assessment each year. But Anderson says high deductibles raise some troubling issues.
And that is whether it is inherently disadvantaged to lower-income employees. And we struggle with that. A $1,000 deductible, if you're making $100,000 a year, is no big deal. If you're making $30,000 a year, a $1,000 deductible is a big deal.
Anderson says in the future, employers will probably link deductibles to workers' wages to keep costs more fair. Allison Kojak, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Cavan Group, helping businesses make the right choices for data centers, disaster recovery, and cloud services. Learn more at Cavan, C-A-V-A-N, group.com. And Dana-Farber Brigham and Women's Cancer Center, with specialists available to see new patients as soon as the next day. Call 877-DFCI-BWH or visit youhaveus.org.
Go to WBUR.org today for a new WBUR poll out that shows Hillary Clinton well ahead of Donald Trump in the Bay State. And on WBUR's opinion page, Cognoscenti, the mystery of the undecided voter. Cognoscenti, thinking that matters on WBUR.org. Could have more showers overnight tonight. Lows about 60. Sun's back tomorrow. Highs just about 70. 84 degrees now at 10 to 5.
WBUR supporters include Boston University's Questrom MBA. Go further, faster, and earn your degree your way with a BU MBA, full-time or part-time, as specialized or as general as you like. Learn more. Attend an info session Monday, September 19th at 6 p.m. Register at bu.edu/futureMBA. And Grill 23 and Bar, Steakhouse and Seafood Grill, featuring six private dining rooms for all of your special events in Boston. Inquiries at grill23.com.
This election year has seen its share of wrong turns.
My editor's like, drive to Exeter, New Hampshire, to see Donald Trump.
NPR reporter Sam Sanders knows something about that.
I drive and drive and drive. 2 hours later, you won't guess where I am. I'm in Exeter, Rhode Island.
We get you where you need to go to keep you informed, even if we have to take the long way there. Listen every day.
Right here on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Kelly McEvers. The world's biggest producer of seeds for farmers, Monsanto, announced this morning it has agreed to be bought by Bayer, the huge German pharmaceutical company. The deal faces a lot of regulatory hurdles. Critics say it could leave farmers all over the world dependent on just a few companies. NPR's Dan Charles met some of those farmers today in Canada.
The farm show in Woodstock, Ontario is a huge event. 100 acres full of all kinds of farming tools. Monsanto is one of the biggest tents here. Farmer Don Kolkuk is standing outside it, digesting the news that this company's agreed to be swallowed by Bayer.
It's blowing my mind. I just didn't realize that this would ever occur.
Most of the farmers at this show buy products from both companies. Genetically engineered corn and soybean seeds from Monsanto, pesticides from Bayer. In the future, those products might all come from one company. And this is only the latest deal in the seed and pesticide industry. DuPont and Dow are trying to merge. A state-owned chemical company in China is buying Syngenta, which is based in Switzerland. Here's Kelly Sharp, another farmer.
It scares me, the consolidation. That's what scares me, and the control, right? You get so few players in the business, they pretty much dictate their price and everything about it.
Antitrust regulators in several countries will have to sign off on this deal. The combined company would control about 30% of the global seed business. Monsanto and Bayer say together they'll create new and better products. Farmer Roger Kell says that could be true.
On the positive side, they will have access to more technologies, which is what it's all about, really, from their point of view. And that might benefit agriculture as well.
And Quentin Martin, who grows genetically modified corn seed under contract to Monsanto, he wonders whether this deal will change the global debate over GMOs. Like most of the farmers here, he likes biotech crops. He's frustrated that Europe has not embraced them. But Bayer is a German company.
Now that Europe owns this stuff, will they be more inclined to embrace it? And I'm hoping the answer is yes.
The name Monsanto has become so controversial, he says, the best thing would be to bury it. Dan Charles, NPR News, Woodstock, Ontario.
Close your eyes and listen to this. Well, not if you're driving, but see if you can figure out what instruments are creating the sound. You might think it's woodwinds, brass, or strings, but the musician in that piece are playing instruments made out of cans and bottle caps. It's the recycled orchestra from Cataura, Paraguay. The young musicians are the subject of a new documentary film. NPR's Anastasia Tsiolkas has their story.
Cataura is not a town, really. It's a slum alongside a landfill not far from Paraguay's capital. Every day, about 3 million pounds of solid waste get dumped there. Many families eke out their existence by scavenging trash to resell, and kids regularly get pulled out of school to help. During rainstorms, the landfill floods, and residents have to wade through contaminated water.
Y realmente lo como bueno, siéndote sincera, nada.
Really, to be honest with you, there was practically nothing in Cataura. What there was most was drugs.
That 16-year-old violinist, Noelia Rios. Her violin, like many in the orchestra, is made out of cans, wooden spoons, and bent forks. One of the ensemble's cellos uses an oil drum for its body. Drum heads are made from old X-ray film held in place with copious amounts of packing tape. 15-year-old Tobias Armoa describes his saxophone.
caño de canaleta donde cae el agua de lluvia.
It's made out of a drain pipe where the rainwater falls. Melted copper, coins, spoon handles, and cans.
The recycled orchestra was founded 10 years ago by Fabio Chavez.
Después fui a trabajar a Cateura como técnico.
I went to work in Cateura as an environmental engineer. I saw that there were a lot of children there, and I had the idea to teach them music in my free time.
Chavez's classes became so popular that they soon ran out of donated instruments. So he asked local carpenter Nicolas Gomez to make new instruments for his group, out of stuff from the landfill. Several years ago, the orchestra caught the attention of a team of filmmakers led by Alejandra Amarilla. She knew that most people outside Paraguay had no clue about her home country, so the team went looking for a story to tell.
It was mostly to be able to create awareness on children's issues, but the uniqueness of the story that I ended up picking was that it contained a very strong emotional component and very inspiring.
4 years ago, the film team made a short video for a Kickstarter campaign, hoping to raise $175,000 to make a full-length documentary. Not only did they raise the money, the video went viral. Since then, the recycled orchestra has played Mozart, Paraguayan folk music, even Frank Sinatra, for audiences around the world, including Pope Francis. The young musicians have also backed up Stevie Wonder, Metallica, and Megadeth. These days, kids from Cateura are flocking to join the orchestra. 10-year-old Cynthia Servin plays violin.
Quería tocar porque me gustaba que ellos estaban tocando y que conocían países.
It seemed like they liked what they were playing, and I wanted to visit other countries.
The recycled orchestra has brought a lot of good to Cateura. Money from international touring has funded the building of new, safer homes for several members of the group and their families, and the orchestra's lead instrument maker. Fabio Chavez says there's also been a bigger change.
Que realmente lo que hemos ganado, lo que hemos logrado.
What we have achieved is that in the community, children are respected, and respect for the moment that they need to get an education. It's something sacred. Before, it wasn't like this. The mom or dad would take the kid away by the hand because they had to go to work. Today, that's unthinkable. And we've already achieved the most difficult thing, which is to change the community.
Maybe it didn't have to be music that triggered such a fundamental shift. It could have been soccer or chess or theater. But Chavez says the kids playing in the recycled orchestra are creating something gorgeous out of nothing.
Para ser músico, uno tiene que ser responsable, persistente.
To be a musician, you have to be responsible, persistent, tenacious, conscientious, and sensitive. Without these values, you can't be a musician. But music has such a great power that it can't be just of the musicians. Music can transform society.
Even more people will learn about that transformation as the documentary, Landfill Harmonic, opens in theaters around the U.S. this month and screens later on HBO Latino. Anastasia Tsiulkas, NPR News, New York.
You can see and hear members of the Recycled Orchestra play on a Manhattan rooftop at NPR.org. It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org. Basecamp, working to help everyone on business teams, both on-premise and remote, stay organized with features like built-in chat, collaboration, and secure online file storage. Learn more at Basecamp.com. .com/NPR. And Angie's List, now offering everyone access to over 10 million ratings and reviews, with a continued commitment to providing its members with transparency about local services. More at angieslist.com. Angie's List, home is where our heart is.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Showers have blown through the region. We could have rain or thunderstorms developing tonight. Some strong winds, too. Overnight, it should eventually turn clear, though, with lows about 60. Tomorrow, sunny, dry, and cooler. Should top out at about 70 degrees. 80 degrees now in the Boston area at 1 before 5. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Babson College. Redefine your career as an entrepreneurial leader with the MBA program that's right for you. Classes in Boston and Wellesley, babson.edu. And Boston Laser, comprehensive eye care in Wellesley, Medford, Brookline, and the Merrimack Valley. Learn more at bostonlaser.com. Your eyes, our vision. From Boston University, this is 90.9 WBUR Boston, also broadcasting on 92.7 WBUA Tisbury, Martha's Vineyard, and 89.1 WBUH, Brewster, Cape Cod. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station, with live streaming at WBUR.org. The White House says it plans to raise the number of refugees it allows into the U.S. by tens of thousands this year.
The president believes the United States has a responsibility as a leader on so many issues around the world to play an important role in bringing refugees to the United States.
It's Wednesday, September 14th. This is All Things Considered. Refugee numbers coming up. Good afternoon, I'm Lisa Mullins. Also ahead, the Marine Corps is investigating allegations of abuse and hazing at its recruit training center at Parris Island, South Carolina.
Marines failed to supervise what was going on within their own unit. Since they did not supervise properly, other Marines decided to create an environment that allowed maltreatment to happen.
We look at the major presidential candidates' proposed policies on child care and paid family leave. And fashion consultant Tim Gunn dares the industry to start making clothing for women above size 12. These stories and much more still to come. It's now 1 minute past 5.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Donald Trump today toured a Flint, Michigan water treatment facility that was at the heart of a scandal over lead-contaminated drinking water. The Republican presidential candidate making his visit to the city where lead-tainted water ultimately affected 100,000 people. Trump was shown around by the plant supervisor. The tour comes on the same day as campaigners discussing the fact he turned over medical records to TV host and Dr. Mehmet Oz. Details of that exam are expected to be discussed on a segment set to air tomorrow. Former President Bill Clinton is filling in for his wife on the campaign trail today. That's as Hillary Clinton continues to recover from a bout of pneumonia. Bill Clinton largely brushing off his wife's illness, saying she's feeling better and expects to be back out campaigning by Thursday.
It's a crazy time we live in, you know, when people think there's something unusual about getting the flu. Last time I checked, millions of people were getting it every year.
Hillary Clinton's campaign released a statement saying she is being treated with antibiotics and that a recent medical exam showed she is in good physical condition. Addressing supporters in Nevada today, Bill Clinton noted his wife has been standing in for him for a long time. It's time he did the same for her. A Marine investigation into hazing and abuse of recruits at Parris Island, South Carolina, says officers created the atmosphere that led to the suicide of one recruit. NPR's Tom Bowman reports the investigation centered on one battalion of hundreds of recruits. About 20 Marine officers and drill instructors and are facing punishment.
Marine Corps spokesman Major Chris Devine said it all came down to a lack of leadership, including a battalion commander labeled a toxic leader.
Marines failed to supervise what was going on within their own unit.
One recruit, who was a Pakistani immigrant, was called a terrorist by a drill instructor. The recruit talked about suicide on March 18th, but recanted that same day. A week later, after being abused and slapped hard by a drill instructor, the recruit jumped from a third-story balcony and died. Another recruit, investigators say, was placed inside an industrial dryer and mocked for his Muslim faith. Tom Bowman, NPR News, Washington.
Doctors say former Israeli President Shimon Peres is showing some signs of improvement after suffering a massive stroke. He remains hospitalized. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more.
Peres suffered bleeding to the brain, and doctors are keeping him sedated and on a ventilator. But when doctors have reduced his sedation, they say he has regained consciousness and squeezed his doctor's hand. Peres is 93 years old and a veteran Israeli leader with a career spanning 7 decades. He's remained active. Yesterday, before suffering the stroke, he gave an hour-long lecture. He has plenty of political foes in Israel, but even they have been offering wishes for his recovery. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Jerusalem.
After several sessions of erratic moves, stocks mostly closed lower today, though technology sector shares did show some upward momentum. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 31 points to end the session at 18,034. The NASDAQ rose 18 points. The S&P 500 was down a point today. You're listening to NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. Good afternoon, I'm Lisa Mullins. The acting Gloucester police chief says the department's so-called Angel Initiative will continue in the absence of Police Chief Leonard Campanello. The initiative allows people to turn in their illegal drugs without facing criminal charge in exchange for drug treatment. Chief Campanello is currently on paid administrative leave pending the outcome of an internal investigation. A statement from his lawyer says the investigation has nothing to do with his official duties. Campanello was honored at the White House in April for the Angel program success. Six drug cases have been dismissed and hundreds more are being reviewed following an investigation into drugs, money, and guns that are missing from the Braintree Police Department's evidence room. Norfolk DA Michael Morrissey said today that his office is reviewing between 200 and 400 criminal drug cases as a result of an audit. Morrissey says his office will try to determine if there's the possibility of the evidence being lost or tampered with. Jury selection's underway in the resentencing trial of Gary Lee Sampson. Sampson was sentenced to death after he pleaded guilty to two separate carjackings in 2001 that led to the murders of two men. WBUR's David Boweri reports the prospective jurors were introduced to Sampson today.
He's about to turn 57 years old. He looks grayer, fatter, balder than he did upon his arrest in 2001. He also does not have that same menacing glower that we saw in the photographs taken of him in the state courts where he first appeared after being arrested.
The new jury will decide if Sampson should get the death penalty or life in prison. In 2003, a federal jury gave him the death penalty. That decision was overturned after a judge found one of the jurors had lied about their background. The cities of Chelsea and Somerville are getting more to create more than 800 new units of mixed-income public housing. The developments are being funded through $600,000 grants from the state. Governor Charlie Baker says it's all part of a partnership that looks for new ways to develop state-owned land by working with developers and local housing groups. Rick Porcello pitches for Boston tonight in the Sox third and final game against the Orioles. Rookie outfielder Andrew Benedetti has come off the disabled list from his sprained left knee. And in the forecast, could have some more showers overnight tonight. Watch out for falling tree limbs or branches. Temperatures about 60. Sunshine tomorrow. Highs about 70. This is WBUR.
Funding for WBUR Weather Reports comes from Charles River Apparel, founders of the original New Englander rain jacket, and now apparel for every season. The 2017 collection is at charlesriverapparel.com. Other supporters include Staples, with copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom-framed prints and posters. More at Staples Stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Kelly McEvers. Hillary Clinton's campaign has now released more details about her health. Her doctor gives some details about her bout with pneumonia and says a complete physical exam was otherwise normal. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris is with us now to talk about this update. Hello there.
Hi, Kelly.
So what have we learned from this new medical information?
Well, her doctor, Lisa Bardak, gives us a little bit more information about her pneumonia, which obviously was in the news over the weekend. The report says it was caused by a non-contagious bacterium. It was diagnosed Friday with a CT scan, which found a small right middle lobe pneumonia, if you want the real details there.
Okay.
Clinton is being treated with the antibiotic Levaquin, which she's supposed to take for 10 days.
The Clinton campaign says the pneumonia was the reason she left a 9/11 ceremony unexpectedly on Sunday and showed signs of being weak on her feet. She's been off the campaign trail since. What does the doctor have to say about that?
Well, the note says that her doctor examined her again today and that Clinton is recovering well with antibiotics and rest. It says she continues to improve.
What else is in this health summary that came out this afternoon?
Well, among other things, there's a list of laboratory findings, which were all within the normal range, according to the report. That includes fasting blood glucose, certain vitamin levels, the sorts of things you get when you go to your doctor, and including cholesterol levels. Her cholesterol, by the way, her total cholesterol is 189, which is a good number. And she also has a lower than average blood pressure, 100 over 70. That's not considered unhealthily low, but people with lower readings of blood pressure are more prone to lightheadedness and, in extreme cases, fainting.
Any signs of more serious medical conditions?
No, not in these records, actually. It says she has been screened for breast cancer and came back with normal readings. Dr. Bardick also says that Clinton is in excellent mental condition. We haven't read the full additional report as yet, so there may be some more details that are worth discussing. But at this point, it's, pluses, I would say. And the big picture here is that there are no medical concerns that would impede her ability to serve as president. That's her doctor's conclusion.
What have we heard from other candidates?
We are told that her vice presidential running mate, Tim Kaine, will release his medical record soon as well. There's no word on what Mike Pence is going to do. He's the Republican candidate for vice president. And Republican Donald Trump says he had a complete physical exam last week. He said he would release those results sometime this week. He taped a conversation with a controversial TV host, Dr. Mehmet Oz, today, and that's supposed to air tomorrow. On that, Oz talked to Trump somewhat about his health, but we don't really know the full details of that conversation.
It's NPR's Richard Harris on the health of the presidential and vice presidential candidates. Thank you very much.
Anytime.
The Obama administration says it is planning to boost the number of refugees it takes in by tens of thousands this year. It's in talks with Congress about that, and the news comes as President Obama prepares to lead a summit on refugees at the United Nations next week. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has the story.
The UN is struggling to cope with the highest number of refugees since World War II. 65 million people have been uprooted by war. 21 million of them have crossed international borders. And it's not just the conflict in Syria that is driving this. Conflicts around the world are stretching the UN's refugee agency. The agency's Asia director, Daisy Dell, says only a tiny fraction of the world's refugees are formally resettled in programs like the U.S. one. But any bit helps.
Resettlement in a way is a burden-sharing mechanism that shows that the international community cares, that everybody understands that there are large populations in the country that need solutions. And I think for the countries concerned, it really makes a difference.
Secretary of State John Kerry briefed members of Congress this week on plans to bring in 110,000 refugees, up from 85,000 in this fiscal year. White House spokesman Josh Earnest wouldn't say how many would be from Syria, but points out that refugees go through more security screenings than any other traveler to the U.S. And he says it's important for the U.S. to do this.
The president believes the United States has a responsibility as a leader on so many issues around the world to play an important role in bringing refugees to the United States.
The president will be asking other countries to do more when he chairs a summit on refugees next Tuesday at the UN. The UN is also hosting a meeting the day earlier where the UNHCR's Daisy Dell says member states will renew their commitments to the 1951 Convention on Refugees.
That's been challenged by a number of countries in the world right now.
In her region, she's struggling with Australia, which has been turning away undocumented migrants, sending them off to processing centers on tiny Pacific Island nations.
Illegal arrival does not disqualify you from being a refugee. In World War II, most of the Jews did not have passports and visas when they were leaving, and trying to find protection. So we disagree with Australia that you're disqualified because you don't have proper documentation.
Dell is hoping that the meetings at the UN next week will draw attention to this and raise more financial pledges. She says the refugee agency's budget for Asia has dropped by a third as resources shift to the Middle East and Syria. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Tim Gunn says the fashion industry is not making it work for plus-size women. In the Washington Post, he calls it a disgrace. Gunn, of course, is a fixture in the fashion world, a longtime design educator, and the Emmy-winning co-host of the show Project Runway. His piece in the Post calls on designers to get over their disdain, lack of imagination, or even cowardice, and make clothes for women above a size 12. Tim Gunn is with us from our bureau in New York. Thanks for being here.
Kelly, I'm honored to be with you. Thanks so much for wanting to talk.
So the piece was published just as New York Fashion Week was getting underway. That ends tomorrow. And you wrote that you were not expecting to see the majority of American women get attention on the runways in New York. Were you right?
Oh, absolutely right. I didn't even have to see the shows to know that I would be correct.
Uh-huh.
There were some plus-size models on the runway, and I'm happy to say that Christian Siriano led that cause. Mm-hmm. And what I loved about his show was that he fully integrated the models who were larger than a size 12 with all the little double and triple zeros, and it was all seamless.
You cited a lot of figures in your argument that designers aren't paying enough attention to plus sizes. A Washington State University study that shows that the average American woman now wears between a size 16 and 18.
Yes.
And that plus size women are spending more on clothes than what you describe as straight size women. Is this more an argument that the market needs to correct itself, or is this more of just a populist call for fashion for everyone?
Well, the market does need to correct itself. And I blame certainly the fashion design industry. I blame the retail industry. When I was at Liz Claiborne, I was in a position to be face-to-face with major retailers. And I would ask the question about this, to which I would be told, well, she doesn't spend that much. And I said, have you been in your own department for these women? The clothes are hideous. If I were she, I wouldn't shop either. Also, how do you find the department? It's usually stuck behind pots and pans. It's just so marginalized, it's insulting. And it needs to change. I mean, there are 100 million women in this country who are larger than a size 12. If I were a retailer, gee, I would certainly like to help corner that market.
Yeah. What have you heard from designers and other people in the industry since you published this piece?
Well, I'll tell you, it has been very polarizing.
Huh.
There have been people who have rallied around this cause and said, yes, we need to do more. And then there have been other people who have basically said, how dare you point a finger at this industry? And how dare you try to strip away all this glitz and glamour that we represent? To which I said, you mean glitz and glamour can only go with a size 00 eating disorder person? Is that what you're saying? Because as far as I'm concerned, glitz and glamour knows no boundaries.
You yourself have gotten pushback for writing about clothes that can help us look, quote, taller and slimmer. What do you say to people who are offended by that?
I mean, I'm more of an advocate for having us look long and lean than I am an advocate for having us look short and squat, because we simply look better. But my point is, if you are short and squat, you can look long and lean.
You are also no fan of cropped pants.
No.
I know a lot of women who looked down at their bare ankles when they read that one. If cropped pants are a no-no, why is everyone wearing them?
Well, I have a theory about the crop pant, and it's the following.
Do tell.
Women are very busy, and with a crop pant, you only have to worry about one measurement, the waist. You don't have to worry about how long is it. You don't have to ask yourself, what shoe will I wear with this? Because it doesn't really matter. But it cuts your leg off at the widest part of the calf, and it's not flattering.
Okay, so given what is out there right now, aside from just brands, when women who are shopping for size 16, size 20, what's your advice? I mean, what besides cropped pants should women not buy?
I would say that women should stay away from items that are one piece, meaning a dress or a jumpsuit. You can buy separates and have it still look like one piece. They're so much easier to fit. Hmm. Colors are important, and jewel tones tend to be more flattering on most people than pastels, which are washed out and tend to make us look washed out. Prints are wonderful, but they can be dicey. I'm an advocate for a medium-sized print, nothing too small. It looks infantile, nothing too big, and we all end up looking like a couch. The rules are very similar, whether you're a size 2 or you're a size 22. And silhouette, proportion, and fit are critical. And also on the topic of fit, our clothes need to skim us. They shouldn't hug us like a wetsuit, and they shouldn't cascade away from us like a giant muumuu.
Unless you, of course, want to be wearing a muumuu for any...
Well, that's true. There are occasions when it's very appropriate, or if that's your style. I mean, I don't believe in making anyone into my dress-up doll. And any make-betters that I do are truly a collaboration. I pummel people with questions, ask them, what do you do? With whom do you interact? How do you want to present yourself to the world? And then let's do it the best that we possibly can.
That is Tim Gunn, All Things Considered's new fashion correspondent.
Kelly, okay? I'll take that mantle in a second.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Tim Gunn's piece in the Washington Post is called Designers Refuse to Make Clothes to Fit American Women. It's a disgrace.
WBUR's Edward R. Murrow Society Leadership Giving advances quality journalism. Get the scoop at wbur.org/Murrow Society.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by GEICO, protecting people and their vehicles for over 75 years. GEICO is proud to offer car insurance and more to Massachusetts drivers, too. Additional information at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Still to come on All Things Considered, the candidates' take on family leave and child care policy. In business, oil prices fell sharply. A barrel is now $43.58. That helped send stocks down on Wall Street today. The Dow fell about 0.2% or 32 points. It finished the session at 18,035. S&P was down a small fraction. It ended the day at 21.26, and the NASDAQ managed a small gain. It was up about 0.3% to finish at 51.74. Marketplace has details in just over an hour. It's 19 past 5.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston University's Questrom MBA. Go further faster and earn your degree your way with a BU MBA, full-time or part-time, as specialized or as general as you like. Learn more. Attend an info session Monday, September 19th at 6 p.m. Register at bu.edu/futureMBA.
Could have a few more showers or thunderstorms overnight tonight. After they move out of the area, though, we should be left with drier and cooler air from Canada. Tonight's temperatures fall to about 60. Then tomorrow only making it to 70 despite plenty of sunshine. More sun ahead for Friday as well. It is 78 degrees now in the Boston area. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Novo Nordisk, which is committed to a healthy economy, environment, and society as part of everything it does. Learn more about their commitment at novonordisk.us. And the University at Buffalo. Whether fighting muscular dystrophy with spider venom or creating magma to measure the destructive power of volcanoes, the University at Buffalo believes it's not just what they do, it's how. Learn more at buffalo.edu/how.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Kelly McEvers. It's time now for Platform Check, where we examine what the candidates say they will do if they become president.
We should raise the national minimum wage.
And we will build the wall.
Our tunnels, our ports, our airports. They need work, and there are millions of jobs
to
be done.
New trade policies that put American workers first.
Today we're going to talk about family policies. That's paid leave and child care. This week, Donald Trump unveiled a package of programs aimed at helping working families and also aimed at winning over more women voters. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton already had her policies spelled out. Here to compare the two is Danielle Kurtzleben. Hi there.
Hi.
So Donald Trump is offering maternity leave, and that is not something that he has been offering for a long time. Where did this come from and what's in the plan?
Right. So it's generally understood that his daughter, Ivanka, at the Republican National Convention this summer, really started putting the spotlight on this issue for the Trump campaign. Here's what she said then.
As president, my father will change the labor laws that were put in place at a time when women were not a significant portion of the workforce. And he will focus on making quality childcare affordable and accessible for all.
So that really made people sit up and take notice. It brought maternity leave front and center for the Trump campaign in a way it hadn't been before. And like I said, maternity, this is for new moms but not new dads. What he's offering is 6 weeks through the unemployment insurance program, and he would not be offering mothers a full replacement of the wages that they are losing.
So once someone comes back from maternity leave, someone else needs to watch the kids, right? So what's Donald Trump proposing to be done about that, about child care?
Really central to this program is a tax deduction, which he explained in a speech on Tuesday.
They will fully be able to deduct the average cost of child care for their state from birth through the age of 13.
Now, when he first proposed this last month, he was really criticized because this plan seemed like it would really help rich families a lot more than poor families. After all, a lot of low-income families in the U.S. don't pay any income tax, and therefore, a deduction really wouldn't help them. So, yesterday, he tacked on something else. It's a rebate of up to $1,200 for these lower-income families. Now, let's put that into perspective, $1,200. I mean, if you pay for childcare, you know that that isn't a whole lot. In some, especially in some really expensive cities, it can cost $20,000 or even more.
Right. Donald Trump yesterday said that Hillary Clinton does not have a plan for family policy, but she does have a plan. What is it?
You're absolutely right. She does have a plan, and she's had a lot of plans in this family-friendly area for a while. Central to this is 12 weeks of family leave, and she is stressing that it is not just maternity. It is for moms. It is for dads. It's for taking care of other family members. It can be for elder care, for example. Her plan would replace around two-thirds of a person's lost wages. Now, as for child care, she's really emphasizing that she wants to really help families cut back on how much they have to pay for child care. Here she is in her economic address this summer.
So we have to make it easier to be good workers, good parents, and good caregivers all at the same time. That's why I've set out a bold vision to make quality, affordable child care available to all Americans and limit the cost to 10% of family income.
So she said limit there, but the Clinton campaign has also been talking about this as a goal that they're trying to reach over time.
And these are really ambitious plans. How are these candidates going to pay for it?
So both candidates have provided pretty loose outlines. Donald Trump has said that he would pay for his maternity leave by getting rid of unemployment fraud. By one estimate, there's $3 billion of unemployment fraud out there. So that's not a lot of money when you consider how much all of these policies could cost. You know, it could be in the hundreds of billions of dollars. The Clinton campaign, meanwhile, like with a lot of her policies, has said she is going to pay for it more with taxes on the wealthy. So that's really how the Clinton campaign is going to try to get at that.
So one of the things that's striking here is that both candidates are talking about these family issues. I mean, we didn't hear as much of an emphasis on these issues in past campaigns. But why are they talking about this now?
Well, it's been kind of a slow growth in the movement to provide better paid family leave and other family-friendly policies. And one reason that's happening is that women are increasingly the primary breadwinners in their families. There are lots of single mothers out there, and aside from that, women are very well educated these days. They're earning more. And by the way, women vote more than men do. Aside from that, the conversation is slowly getting less gendered. Millennial men in particular are also open to, you know, taking care of children. They really want their families to also have these kind of policies.
That's NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture is still a construction zone, and it is just 10 days from opening. Still, NPR's Sam Sanders got a tour of the museum on the National Mall in Washington.
Today was Media Day at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Flora Pessoa welcomed about 300 journalists.
My, 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 what a crowd.
Inside the space, there were just as many hard hats as reporters. You could hear drills humming on every floor, even as the grand opening is set for 10 days from now. Lonnie Bunch is the founding director of the museum, and this morning he reminded people just how far the museum has come from a dream of Black Civil War veterans over a century ago, from still just being a dream last decade.
11 years ago, we really did start this with a staff of two, no collections at all. We really had even no idea exactly where the site of the museum would be. We knew we had to raise a lot of money, but we didn't know where we were going to get that money from. All we knew is that we had a vision.
And it's quite the vision. It's hard to overstate just how much work has gone into the museum. There are artifacts like a Jim Crow era segregated train car that was lowered underground years ago.
And so this train car was down here how long before the thing was done?
Before they put the roof on it. So that was 4 years ago, I think it was, that we dropped that down.
Wow.
So,
and it just sat here until it was built around.
Yeah, they built it in a casework around the thing to protect it. It was the first artifact to come into the building.
That was Robert Anderson, one of the museum's architects. Damian Thomas curated the sports sections of the museum. He walked me through an Olympics display.
We have 9 of Carl Lewis's 10 Olympic medals.
Where's the 10th?
The 10th medal is buried with his father.
This is the kind of dedication donors have shown to the museum. Thomas says many, including lots of regular people you've never heard of, gave big parts of their lives to this museum.
That's been what's been most amazing about this journey for me, that people have opened up their homes and entrusted us with their most prized possessions.
As big as the Museum of African American History and Culture is, and as much stuff is in there, not everything could fit. There are thousands of artifacts on display, but that's just a fraction of all that was collected.
We started with no artifacts, 0 artifacts. We now have about 37,000 artifacts in the museum's collection. We are displaying around 3,000 of those 37,000
artifacts. Where are the other 34,000?
They are in the Smithsonian Storage Facility.
That's Bill Pretzer, another curator at the museum. He told me that even with all they've collected so far, the work isn't over yet.
We will be collecting ad nauseum, and we will continue to collect on issues that we think are important for future exhibitions. As a matter of fact, opening the museum starts the work.
Curator Talani Salahuddin just wants one point to be made clear when the public finally does see the museum.
African Americans, we have been marginalized. However, we are not marginal. That we have been central to this country from its founding to the very present.
The Museum of African American History and Culture opens to the public September 24th. Sam Sanders, NPR News, Washington.
Is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. We could be in for some more showers or thunderstorms overnight tonight. Watch out for falling tree limbs or branches. Tomorrow, no rain, just sunny skies, highs about 70. Friday, sunshine yet again. Red Sox and Orioles play the rubber game of their series tonight at Fenway. Rick Porcello pitches. Boston's lost to Baltimore last night. Cuts the Sox lead in the AL East to 2 games. It's 5:30.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Catalent, offering on-demand access to a network of 30,000 business professionals to help your team accomplish more at GoCatalent.com. Applegate natural and organic deli meats, free of artificial ingredients and preservatives, and made from animals with room to roam, with no antibiotics ever, Applegate.com. And Get in Shape for Women, small group personal training. Learn more about fall plans for new members at GetInShapeForWomen.com.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Understanding this year's race for the White House requires more than following the polls and the stump speeches. At WBUR, we bring you stories about the most important issues in November's election and how they affect you and others in our community. We take our mission seriously. If you believe in our mission, remember that listener support makes WBUR possible. We appreciate our contributing listeners, and we thank you for your generous support.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Republican nominee Donald Trump taped an interview about his medical history today with controversial celebrity doctor Mehmet Oz. NPR's Jessica Taylor reports they reviewed the latest results from Trump's physical exam done last week.
According to a statement from the Dr. Oz Show, the 70-year-old candidate discussed his cardiovascular health, prostate health, family medical history, and more. In an unusual letter last year, Trump's doctor had proclaimed he would be the, quote, healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency. Press were not allowed inside the taping, but some audience members told NBC News afterwards that Dr. Oz told Trump he had good lab results, including his blood pressure and cholesterol. He is slightly overweight, though, reportedly at 267 pounds. Trump admitted he doesn't exercise much and said campaigning is his form of physical activity. And he doubled down on his affinity for fast food. Jessica Taylor, NPR News, Washington.
The episode is set to air tomorrow. Meanwhile, the Clinton campaign released a summary this afternoon of Hillary Clinton's current medical information. The report shows lab and exam results that are typical for a 68-year-old woman. Clinton is taking medication for an underactive thyroid, and she's currently on an antibiotic for a bout of pneumonia. Clinton's doctor says her blood pressure is 100 over 70, which is normal, and she is in excellent mental condition. Too little, too late, a House committee has passed legislation today to prohibit the government from making cash payments to Iran, but it comes a week after the Obama administration says it delivered the last payment to settle a decades-old claim between the two countries. Congressman Ed Royce from California.
This cash was held until the hostages left Iran. The State Department now says, well, that's leverage. To me, it was textbook ransom.
The Obama administration rejects the charge. Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street. The Dow lost 31 points, or 0.2%. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is expressing confidence in the Boston Police Department's new pilot program that equips officers with body cameras. The program was delayed after a police union challenged it in court. Walsh told Radio Boston today that he believes opposition to the program came from union leadership and not from the police officers themselves.
a lot of the officers, particularly the newer officers, said, there's no problem with this. We're used to this stuff with cameras and with iPhones and all the other stuff. So we can't dwell on the issue of the lawsuit. We got to move beyond it because we've done some great things in our city.
Walsh says body cameras alone are not enough to improve community relations with police. He says only dialogue and conversation can do that. Six drug cases in Braintree have been dismissed by prosecutors. That follows an investigation into drugs, money, and guns that are missing from the Braintree Police Department's evidence room. Prosecutors are expected to seek the dismissal of many more drug cases as a result of an audit of the room. The union that represents nurses at the Holy Family Hospital in Methuen are filing an unfair labor practice charge against the owner of the hospital. The Mass Nurses Association filed the complaint against Steward Healthcare. Nurses claim the company refuses to provide information they say is needed to begin new contract talks. And hundreds of elderly patients on Cape Cod are looking for new doctors after a house call program announced it's going to close its doors. The Hope Health Home Care Program sent doctors to the homes of about 200 patients for the past 4 years. But CEO Diana Franquito says that the low insurance payments and high travel times made it impossible to see enough patients to make a profit.
On a good day, you can make seven home visits. And when you're in an office, you can have 20 to 25 patient encounters.
Franquito says Hope Health is working with its remaining patients to find new doctors. In the forecast, after showers entirely move out of the area tonight, we should be left with drier and cooler air. Temperatures falling to about 60. And then for tomorrow, should be a chilly day. Highs only about 70 degrees despite a lot of sunshine. More sun should be ahead for Friday as well. It is 77 degrees now in the Boston area at 534.
Funding for WBUR weather reports comes from GEICO, offering the GEICO mobile app, which stores ID cards and enables bill pay and claim reports directly from your cell phone. Learn more at geico.com. Other supporters include College Vine, where mentors selected from Harvard, Duke, Stanford, and more work with high schoolers to provide mentorship and college admissions guidance. More at collegevine.com.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from ADP, committed to helping businesses build better, more productive workforces with payroll and HR solutions that combine software with human insights and expertise. ADP, a more human resource. More at ADP.com. And Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Kelly McEvers. A new report from the Marine Corps tells the story of longstanding abuse and hazing at its recruit depot at Parris Island, South Carolina. It shows abuse there is linked to the suicide of a recruit earlier this year. Marine Corps spokesman Major Chris Devine said the maltreatment went on for a simple reason.
Marines failed to supervise what was going on within their own unit.
NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman joins us now here in the studio. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Kelly.
And you have read this investigative report. What does it say?
Well, Kelly, it talks about a culture of hazing and abuse going back more than a couple of years. And we're talking about one battalion of several hundred recruits and a dozen or so drill instructors. Now, some of it's juvenile. It's like forcing a recruit to eat four slices of bread and a bagel and a biscuit all at once without water. Mm-hmm. But the most disturbing is what happened to recruit Raheel Siddiqui back in March. He was a Pakistani immigrant from Detroit. He was called a terrorist by his drill instructor. Siddiqui talked about suicide while he was there and later recanted. Then when Siddiqui said he was sick, the drill instructor forced him to run. Siddiqui fell, started crying. The drill instructor slapped him hard, and the recruit immediately ran and jumped off a third-story deck, killing himself. In another case, a Muslim recruit was questioned about his religion, whether he was part of the 9/11 attacks, and he was placed in an industrial dryer by a drill instructor who turned it on repeatedly.
What about the supervisors at this depot?
Well, the problem centers on the battalion commander who's supposed to be in charge. He's Lieutenant
right.
Colonel. Investigators called him, quote, a toxic leader, that he allowed this to happen. He created an atmosphere of abuse going back a couple of years, that he failed to file incident reports. He abused his staff. And again, investigators were looking at this battalion long before the suicide of this recruit. And the officer has since been removed, and his boss, the colonel who ran the recruit regiment, also has been removed.
I mean, we're talking about this one battalion, but you have to ask, I mean, is this kind of behavior more widespread?
Well, there's no indication it's widespread. The Marines will tell you, listen, there are hundreds of drill instructors. There are times when you have these incidents. Now, the drill instructors are supposed to be very tough, of course, but the Marine drill instructor creed says they'll show by their own example the highest standards of personal conduct, morality, and professional skill. Kelly, I've been covering the military a long time now, and there have been similar problems in the past in the Army and the Navy over the years. This is a classic case of abuse of authority and no adult supervision. I mean, look at Abu Ghraib.
Right. Quickly, what happens next?
The investigators are looking at 20 Marines, including officers and drill instructors. You could see a variety of lesser punishments like reduction in rank, loss of pay, but you could see criminal charges and court martials as well. Assault, by the way, is punishable by a dishonorable discharge and up to 8 years in prison.
It's NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Kelly.
President Obama said today he is prepared to lift the last remaining U.S. economic sanctions on Myanmar. That would allow the once isolated country to integrate more fully with the global economy. Obama announced the move after a White House meeting with the de facto leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
President Obama says while Myanmar's transformation from dictatorship to democracy is not complete, reforms have come more quickly than many people expected. One big sign of that was the woman sitting beside Obama in the Oval Office. Aung San Suu Kyi was still a prisoner of house arrest when he came into office. Today, she's an elected leader herself. Obama wants to encourage continued reform by lifting sanctions and restoring Myanmar's favorable trading status.
This will give the United States, our businesses, our nonprofit institutions, greater incentive to invest and participate in what we hope will be an increasingly democratic and prosperous partner for us in the region.
Some human rights watchdogs see the reward for Myanmar as premature, pointing to the country's ongoing mistreatment of ethnic and religious minorities. But Suu Kyi endorsed the lifting of sanctions, saying a growing economy will help to spur further progress.
Unity also needs prosperity, because people, when they have to fight over limited resources, forget that standing together is important.
The White House praised Suu Kyi for enlisting former UN leader Kofi Annan to help bring an end to violence in Myanmar's western state of Rakhine. Obama, who was the first U.S. president to travel to Myanmar, encouraged other Americans to visit as well. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
The oldest lighthouse in the country has a big birthday today. Boston Light, as it's called, is celebrating 300 years as a navigational beacon in Boston Harbor. The lighthouse is still operating and has the only resident lighthouse keeper in the nation. Deborah Becker from member station WBUR recently visited.
On a small rocky island about 10 miles from downtown Boston, the 98-foot-high lighthouse tower looks just like the historic renditions of what it looked like when it was first lit on September 14th, 1716. White stucco, small black iron doors, and a large windowed room at the very top.
That's the classic look that when you see things like on mugs or postcards or different renditions of paintings.
Also preserving historical authenticity is the keeper of Boston Light, Sally Snowman, dressed in Revolutionary-era clothes that she makes herself, a long flowered dress, apron, and bonnet.
The dress that I'm wearing today, it is the garb that the keeper's wife would have worn in 1783.
Why 1783 and not 1716? Because during the Revolutionary War, Boston Light was such an important navigational tool that it became a target for both sides. Americans set it on fire to prevent the British from getting in and out of the harbor, and when the British were forced to withdraw, they planted gunpowder at the base of the tower.
It is not the one built in 1716. That one was blown up by the British in 1776. This is the new one.
And new here is a relative term. 76 steps up to the top of the tower is a 13-foot-tall rare Fresnel lens with hundreds of panels of glass that reflect light that can be seen for 27 nautical miles. That lens dates back to 1859.
And you'll notice that the light that was flashing every 10 seconds mm-hmm. is not a light bulb that's flashing. It's 4,000 pounds of glass and brass rotating.
And despite 21st century technology, Snowman says lighthouses are still important.
There's so many pleasure boaters and small boats, fishermen and lobster women and things like that, that still depend upon that visual sighting. So although vessels have electronics, they have a tendency to fail.
The Coast Guard, which oversees the lighthouse, spent more than $1 million renovating it for this year's anniversary, saying Boston Light represents the cornerstone of the nation's maritime legacy. For NPR News, I'm Deborah Becker in Boston.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Here is what Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson needs to do to get on the debate stage later this month with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. He needs to draw an average of 15% support in major polls. So far, he is short of that, but he is campaigning hard and hoping to catch up by appealing to voters who are turned off by the two major party candidates. Today, he stopped in Detroit. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Gary Johnson, the former Republican two-term governor of New Mexico, is anything but a traditional politician. He's climbed the tallest peaks on every continent, including Mount Everest. He has more than a nodding acquaintance with cannabis in the edible form. His political views, though, are right out of the libertarian playbook. He made a firm promise to his audience today at the Detroit Economic Club.
With certainty, I will tell you that rules and regulations will not get any worse. They'll get better. With certainty, taxes, I'll sign on to any proposal that simplifies taxes. I'll sign on to any proposal that reduces taxes.
And while Johnson believes government should be limited in scope, he calls for the elimination of the Department of Education, for instance, and the closure of many military bases, he believes there are some roles it should perform. Take an issue of particular importance here, the lead contamination of the nearby city of Flint's water system.
It's absolutely a situation that the government should be involved in. Government, I think, has a fundamental responsibility to protect us against those that would do us harm, in this case, pollution. And I support the EPA.
Johnson got more attention for his stumble in an interview last week when he couldn't identify the Syrian city of Aleppo than for just about anything else he's done in his campaign. Johnson says he fully expected to have a gaffe, or what he called an Aleppo moment during the campaign, but that it's important to be able to move on.
There's no excuse for having spaced on Aleppo, somehow thinking it was an acronym, but such is life. And I think also that it's indicative of all of our lives. I mean, all of our lives encompass mistakes. And it's really how we deal with mistakes that ultimately determine success.
Alex Stevens, a student at Oakland University, came to see Johnson today and says he supports him because he talks about issues that are important to younger voters that the other two candidates don't.
Drug legalization or criminal justice reform, these type of things. I think the other two candidates are hesitant to talk about those things because they know it's kind of a touchy area for a lot of voters.
James Hahn, who works for a Detroit bank, calls himself a lifelong Republican but can't support Trump and finds Johnson appealing, though he admits he's a long shot.
He made a lot of good points, and unfortunately I don't think he has a chance, but I may very well go for him, nevertheless.
And that is the kind of attitude Johnson says he needs if he's to have any chance in November.
Nothing is going to change if you're voting for the lesser of two evils. Nothing. The only way things are going to change is if you're voting for something different. And in this case, I think we offer up different in a really big way. And different happens to be mainstream in this election.
Johnson, by the way, says he intends to have his own physical exam tomorrow. The 63-year-old is a triathlete and promises if he does win, he'll be the fittest president to occupy the Oval Office. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Detroit.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by LaSalle Village, a retirement community with class. Join them for A Taste of LaSalle, lunch, lecture, and tours September 23rd. Register at lasallevillage.org. And Peabody Essex Museum presenting American Impressionist Child Hassam. On view now, PEM.org.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Go to WBUR.org today for a new WBUR poll out this morning that shows Hillary Clinton well ahead of Donald Trump in the Bay State. And on WBUR's opinion page, Cognoscenti, the mystery of the undecided voter. Cognoscenti, thinking that matters on WBUR.org. In the forecast overnight tonight, look for a few more showers, maybe some thunderstorms, and then drier and cooler air moves in from Canada. Tonight's temperatures down around 60. Tomorrow making it only to about 70 degrees despite a lot of sunshine. Sunshine back for Friday as well. Rick Porcello pitches for Boston tonight in the Sox third and final game against the Orioles. Rookie outfielder Andrew Benintendi has come off the disabled list from a sprained left knee. This is WBUR. It is now 78 degrees at 10 to 6.
WBUR supporters include the Eisenberg School of Management, presenting Driven, a conversation with Steve Wozniak, moderated by Tom Ashbrook. Eisenberg.umass.edu/NPR. Arts Emerson with Here All Night, a stunning and hypnotic journey into the musical mind of Samuel Beckett. This must-see runs through October 9th. ArtsEmerson.org. And Grand Fondo New England, presented by Cliff Bar. A fall ride in rural Connecticut, October 2nd, to support youth cycling. More at kmccrossfest.com.
I'm gonna keep well my vegetables carved.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. As we get into fall, resident chef Kathy Guntz says, how about some stuffed vegetables?
Stuffed peppers were something like you found in the cafeteria in the 50s and the 60s, and you weren't that happy about them. So I've tried to reinvent them.
That's Here and Now tomorrow at noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm red
as a bee. Jury selection began today in the sentencing retrial of federal defendant Gary Lee Sampson. Sampson already pleaded guilty to committing two carjackings that resulted in the murders of two men. That was in 2001. WBUR's David Boeri reports from the federal courthouse in Boston.
This is an unusual case, Judge Leo Sorokin told nearly 300 prospective jurors called to federal court today. Unusual because the jury will not be deciding guilt or innocence. And unusual because the judge will not be choosing the sentence, the jury will. Jurors can only decide between imposing the death penalty or life in prison without the chance of parole. What the judge did not tell prospective jurors was that the sentencing trial was unusual for still another reason. Years after a previous jury sentenced Sampson to death in 2003, the trial judge overturned the verdict. He had discovered that one of the jurors had lied on her juror questionnaire and thus committed misconduct. Careful to avoid telling these prospective jurors that a previous jury had imposed the death penalty, the judge in this case, Leo Sorokin, told them this. There have been a number of proceedings in this case, and now we are ready for the sentencing trial. In three separate hearings, the judge swore in each panel of prospective jurors and introduced the defendant. Much older, grayer, heavier, and balder, Gary Lee Sampson wore a goatee and black framed glasses and appeared without the menacing glower captured by photographs in his initial state court appearances following his arrest 15 years ago. Another panel of 300 people have been called to court tomorrow. Individual questioning of jurors is scheduled to begin next Wednesday. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm David Boeri.
For the first time today, a Michigan State employee was convicted for actions during the Flint water crisis. This happened as the discussion about what to do with the city's tainted water plays out in courtrooms in Michigan and on Capitol Hill. From Flint, Michigan Radio, Steve Carmody reports.
This morning, 65-year-old Corinne Miller sat quietly in a Flint courtroom. The retired state worker was there to plead no contest to a charge of willful neglect of duty. Miller is the former director of the State Department of Health and Human Services Bureau of Epidemiology. Special Prosecutor Todd Flood told the judge that Miller was aware of a deadly spike in Legionnaires' disease cases in the months following the city's shift to water drawn from the Flint River. He says Corinne Miller believed that the outbreak was linked to the same improperly treated water that was damaging pipes and leaching lead into the city's drinking water. But she did nothing. A dozen people died from Legionnaires' disease during the outbreak. Prosecutor Flood says half the deaths occurred after Miller and two other state health department officials confirmed the outbreak and suspected the water.
They have notice, and they knew bad things were going to happen. And when those bad things weren't prevented, that to me is disturbing. So I said right in there they could have prevented it. They could have used tools. They could have put out an alert. They didn't do anything about that, and that's what's in the plea agreement.
Corinne Miller said little in court and declined comment afterward, but she'll be back. As part of her plea deal, she's cooperating with a broader criminal investigation in which seven current and former state employees have been charged with felonies. Meanwhile, down in Detroit, a federal judge is hearing a lawsuit over Flint residents' access to bottled water. Thousands of Flint residents make daily treks to nine water distribution sites to pick up cases of bottled water. Some live more than 2 miles from those sites. Activist Melissa May says it's an especially hard trip for the 1 in 5 Flint residents who don't own a car.
And then you look at people that are senior citizens. When you have to go carry those cases of water, they're 26 and a half pounds apiece. They can't do that. People who are disabled, what are they supposed to do?
Mays and others want the state to deliver water door to door to ensure everyone in Flint has access to bottled water. From Michigan courtrooms to Congress today, where some of the state's politicians wanted to talk about who will pay for Flint's damaged pipes. So far, about 100 pipes connecting homes to city water mains have been replaced. But there may be more than 10,000 still leaching lead into people's tap water. Michigan gave Flint nearly $30 million for new pipes, but the cost of replacing them all will be much higher. Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow wants Congress to release tens of millions of dollars earmarked for pipe replacement. It's part of a $10 billion piece of legislation funding projects to repair aging municipal water systems across the United States.
We will not give up on the people of Flint until every man, every woman, every child in the city of Flint has the confidence that the water that comes out of their faucet is safe. That should be a basic American right.
Donald Trump came to Flint today to tour the city's water plant and meet with a few residents. Those residents, like many here in Flint, remain dubious of government claims they can safely drink their tap water if it's properly filtered. For NPR News, I'm Steve Carmody in Flint.
Carla Hayden became the 14th Librarian of Congress today. She is the first person to hold the position who isn't a white man, and she faces a huge change in how we interact with information. NPR's Andrew Limbong reports.
It's not an overstatement to say that a little bit of history was made this afternoon.
People of my race were once punished with lashes and worse for learning to read.
That's Carla Hayden at her swearing-in ceremony.
And as a descendant of people who were denied the right to read, to now have the opportunity to serve and lead the institution that is the national symbol of knowledge is a historic moment.
Public service, that was always at the heart of her instruction.
Eunice Anderson worked under Carla Hayden while Hayden was head of Baltimore's Enoch Pratt Free Library. And it was in Baltimore, after the death of Freddie Gray, where Hayden made a national name for herself. There was a library branch right at the epicenter of the unrest. Hayden decided to keep it open. Eunice Anderson says it was for anyone who needed it.
From the children to the adults, she was greeting everybody as they came in. It was very positive.
As Librarian of Congress, she'll have even more on her plate. The library manages collections of books, documents, and music. It handles research for the legislative branch. It deals with copyright And she's got this whole internet thing to think about. It's a tall order. In 2015, the Government Accountability Office even released a report criticizing the library's slow response technology. It was called Strong Leadership Needed to Address Serious Information Technology Management Weaknesses. But Carla Hayden knew all this going in, and she seemed to smile when she repeated,
"So help me God.
So help me God."
Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
And this weekend on All Things Considered, listen for an interview with Carla Hayden. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Constant Contact with email marketing features like drag and drop editing and mobile-friendly templates. Constant Contact is committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits become marketers. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. Creighton University, which believes that the value of a higher education is measured beyond academic excellence. It's about striving to make a difference in the world and to offer students more than an education. Learn more at Creighton.edu. And Craft in America, presenting a new episode called Teachers. Artists share their skills and passion for craft with students of all ages. Teachers premieres Thursday, September 15th, as part of Spotlight Education Week on PBS.
This is WBUR. Showers have blown through much of the region. We could have more rain or thunderstorms overnight tonight. Some strong winds, too. Should eventually clear, though, with lows about 60 overnight. Then tomorrow, sunny, dry, cooler, should top out at 70. Friday, still sunny and pretty nice. Highs in the mid-70s. It is 76 degrees now in the Boston area at 1 before 6.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston University's 18-month executive MBA, accelerating the careers of experienced managers for over 30 years. Find out how a Questrom EMBA can move you to the next level of leadership. Attend an info session September 19th at 6 p.m. Register at bu.edu/executive MBA.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Donald Trump has taped an interview about his medical history with controversial celebrity Dr. Mehmet Oz. NPR's Jessica Taylor reports that in the episode set to air tomorrow, the two review the results of the GOP presidential nominee's physical examination last week.
According to a statement from the Dr. Oz show, the 70-year-old candidate discussed his cardiovascular health, prostate health, family medical history, and more. In an unusual letter last year, Trump's doctor had proclaimed he would be the, quote, healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency. Press were not allowed inside the taping, but some audience members told NBC News afterwards that Dr. Oz told Trump he had good lab results, including his blood pressure and cholesterol. He is slightly overweight, though, reportedly at 267 pounds. Trump admitted he doesn't exercise much and said campaigning is his form of physical activity, and he doubled down on his affinity for fast food. Jessica Taylor, NPR News, Washington.
Hillary Clinton is still recovering from pneumonia. If she returns to campaigning tomorrow as planned, the Democratic presidential nominee faces the task of winning over voters who have been concerned about her ability to be straight with them. President Obama's former senior advisor David Axelrod spoke to NPR's Morning Edition about the challenge Clinton faces over transparency in the wake of controversy over handling of classified information when she was Secretary of State.
I don't think health is as big a challenge for her as stealth. She is a relentless, indefatigable person. I can attest to that. But the concerns that people have run to the other thing, and they ended up creating this a bigger story than the one they were trying to avoid.
President Obama says the U.S. is ready to lift economic sanctions on Myanmar as that country continues its transition to democratic rule. NPR's Scott Horsley says Obama announced the move after a White House meeting with Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi.
President Obama says reforms in Myanmar are not complete, but have moved more quickly than many people expected. Aung San Suu Kyi has gone from being a prisoner under house arrest to a key figure in an elected parliament. So Obama says it's appropriate to lift the remaining U.S. economic sanctions and reward the country, also known as Burma, with favorable trading status.
It is the right thing to do in order to ensure that the people of Burma see rewards from
a new way of doing business and a new government.
The U.S. is still concerned about the outsized role the military plays in Myanmar, as well as that country's treatment of ethnic and religious minorities. Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House.
Meanwhile, the Obama administration plans to take in 110,000 refugees from around the world starting in the new fiscal year that begins October 1st. That is nearly 30% more than the number admitted in the previous year. Before the close, Dow was down 32 at 18,034. This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. The Norfolk County District Attorney has dropped charges in six drug cases because of missing evidence at the Braintree Police Department. WBUR's Fred Tice reports.
One defendant was charged with trafficking in opiates, possession to distribute cocaine, and identity fraud. Charges against him were dropped Monday. Attorney Michael Bennett says his client spent a year in jail because he could not raise bail.
There should be checks and balances in place that would prevent any single rogue officer or group of officers from doing this sort of thing. There should be periodic internal audits.
This spring, the Braintree Police Chief commissioned an audit of his department's evidence room. The officer in charge of the evidence room committed suicide shortly thereafter. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Fred Tice.
The attorney for Gloucester's police chief says an internal investigation into Chief Leonard Campanello has nothing to do with his public duties. Campanello is on indefinite leave but did not disclose what sparked the investigation. His attorney says Campanello will cooperate with the investigation. The police chief has received national attention for his innovative program that allows drug users to turn in their drugs without facing criminal charges as long as they agree to get treated. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh thinks the state and not the city should be providing funding for charter schools. Walsh argues that since the state inspects and licenses charter schools, the state should pay for them as well. Today, Walsh told WBUR's Radio Boston if the state funded charter schools, communities in Boston would have more funds to address other issues.
The funding works through cities and towns. If the state funded these schools directly and took the burden off the city, that's $19 more million in this fiscal year that we're in now.
Walsh says that he's voting against the November ballot question looking to expand the number of charter schools in the state. And the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant remains shut down. The plant was about to begin startup operations today when a mechanical issue was identified. A spokesman for Entergy, the firm that owns the plant, says the problem prevents the main turbine operation. A spokesperson would not say when they expect the plant to be back online. In sports tonight, Game 3 in the Sox and Orioles series at Fenway Park, Rick Porcello pitches for Boston, and in the forecast, could have more rain, thunderstorms developing overnight tonight, some gusty winds as well. And then for tomorrow, sunny, dry, cooler, should make it only to about 70 degrees.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Kelly McEvers. We're starting off this hour with the investigation into the Donald J. Trump Foundation. The Trump campaign calls the investigation by New York's Attorney General a left-wing hit job. Here's NPR's Joel Rose.
New York's Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says he first contacted the Trump Foundation back in June.
Charities have to follow the rules. You can't give money to a political campaign.
That's Schneiderman earlier today on CBS This Morning. Schneiderman says he was investigating reports that Trump's foundation gave money to the Political Action Committee of Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi. That's a clear violation of IRS rules, and the Trump Foundation paid a penalty for it. Schneiderman says that's where his investigation began.
There were allegations that they'd made contributions to political committees, which is illegal. I'm just following the rules as I do with any other charity. We never had a press conference. We never did any grandstanding on this. This is just me doing my job.
Trump's campaign doesn't see it that way. In a statement, a spokesman blasted Schneiderman, a Democrat who's endorsed Hillary Clinton, as a, quote, partisan hack who is simply trying to distract from a bad week for the Clinton campaign. Schneiderman and Trump are not exactly strangers. Schneiderman is already suing the GOP nominee over alleged fraud at his Trump University. Even people who like Schneiderman say he can come off as opportunistic.
One of the most dangerous places in New York is between Mr. Schneiderman and a microphone.
James Fishman is a former prosecutor in the New York Attorney General's office and taught law at Pace University. But that said, Fishman thinks there are potential problems with the way the Trump Foundation is run.
Carelessness, sloppiness, ignorance of either the spirit or the substance of rules.
An investigation by the Washington Post found that Trump Foundation funds were used for some questionable purchases. A football helmet autographed by Tim Tebow that Trump won at a charity auction for $12,000, and a life-sized painting of Donald Trump that his wife won at another charity auction for $20,000. The Post also learned that Trump himself gave no money to his own foundation after 2008. Instead, it takes donations from others and passes them on to charitable causes. Leslie Lankowski teaches philanthropic studies at Indiana University.
When a person gets money from a foundation, they think often that the money is actually that of the person after whom the foundation is named. That certainly isn't true for the Trump Foundation.
Lankowski notes that the foundations of many celebrities and athletes work much the same way, and he says that's not likely to be a legal problem for the Trump Foundation. But it might be an optical problem. Trump talks about giving his own money to charity anonymously. Here he is in an interview with ABC from June.
I give a lot of money to charity. Over a period of years, I've given over $100 million to charity.
But Trump has not given any proof for that claim. He could release his tax returns, which would show what he's given to charity, but Trump is the only presidential candidate in the last 40 years not to release his returns. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
Presidential candidates deliver hundreds of stump speeches over the course of their campaigns. And this week, we're listening closely to the messages that the two major party candidates deliver in city after city. Yesterday, we heard Hillary Clinton. Today, it's Donald Trump. NPR's Sarah McCammon has heard many, many of his speeches as she follows his campaign, and she's with us now. Hi there.
Hey, Kelly.
Donald Trump tends to deliver his stump speeches at these big rallies and these big arenas. Just tell us what that's like.
You know, Kelly, they're all pretty similar. I mean, early in the campaign, he used to be really freeform and never speak from a script. He's been more scripted lately, but, you know, just about every stump speech hits some of the same major themes. We're going to listen now to parts of a speech that Trump gave late last week in Pensacola, Florida. Now, there's always a rotating playlist of very loud music at these rallies. This one opened up with the country song, God Bless the USA.
This is a crowd. There are thousands of people outside that can't get in. Fantastic. Way to go. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
So, Kelly, that was true in this case. There was a big, long line of people who couldn't get in. But Trump tends to say this regardless of the size of the crowd. He pumps them up by telling them that they're part of a movement. And there's a consistent way in which he tries to demonstrate that.
Polls came out today where we're up in Ohio, we're up in Florida, we're up in North Carolina, up. We're up nationwide. CNN 2 days ago, up nationwide.
Okay, so Donald Trump just cited a CNN poll there, but we also often hear him spending a lot of time during his stump speeches actually attacking the media, right?
Right. At just about every rally, he points back to the reporters gathered at the back of the room and calls them dishonest. And, you know, again, he's working with the people in the crowd here who almost always turn around and boo.
And with thousands of people outside, I challenge those cameras to show this arena packed. They never do. They never do. They never, ever do.
Now, the truth is, a lot of crowd photos are taken by the media at Trump rallies because the crowd is just such a huge part of the story.
Okay, so whipping up the crowd, that's clearly a thing that he does at these stump speeches. When he does start talking about substance, what is his message?
So his attacks on the media are kicking off an indictment of something bigger, what he calls the rigged system. He says the establishment, so the government, the mainstream media, have created rules and institutions that are hurting average Americans.
All the people who've rigged the system, and we have had a rigged system, for their own personal benefit, are trying to stop our change campaign because they know that their gravy train has reached its last stop.
And it doesn't take long before Trump lands this message right on his opponent.
It's been happening long enough. And the reason they don't do anything about it is because the special interests and the donors control our politicians, and they control Hillary Clinton.
Does Trump lay out how exactly he thinks the special interests and the donors have controlled politicians?
He doesn't say quite how, but he walks through all the things he says have gone wrong because of people, he says, like Hillary Clinton. You know, her handling of the attack on a U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya, and the private email system she kept while Secretary of State.
Hillary Clinton has presided over the greatest series of power, and you know this, I mean, the greatest series that I've ever seen of foreign policy failures and mistakes and blunders that anyone has ever seen. Everything she touches has turned bad. Now she wants to be president. I mean, the only thing she's done well, and she'll go down in history for it, I have to admit, is getting out of trouble with the emails. That's the single greatest achievement of Hillary Clinton. True.
And you can hear the crowd chanting, lock her up there. So that is Donald Trump's case against Hillary Clinton. How does he lay out his own agenda?
So there are a couple of key issues he always mentions in really every stump speech. Let's hear that.
We're going to pursue new trade policies that put American workers first. And we're going to keep our jobs in our country.
So he's promised to cut better trade deals, even renegotiate existing deals like NAFTA. And then, of course, there's the issue that's been the core of his campaign.
We will also have a very, very strong border. That stops people and drugs. And those drugs are poisoning our youth and poisoning our people from illegally pouring into our country. And we will build the wall, and Mexico will pay for the wall.
Building this wall, of course, has been Trump's biggest, most consistent promise of this campaign. Is it also, you know, during these speeches, is it the biggest moment?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of big moments. It's not just the wall. It's his promise to build up the military, to be tough on our adversaries. And all these lines in Trump's speech feed into the iconic idea of his campaign.
We will be strong. We will be safe. We will win again. Ladies and gentlemen, we will make America great again. Thank you very much. God bless you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.
And often Trump closes his rallies with this Rolling Stones song, "You Can't Always Get What You Want," which matches the kind of defiant tone of his speeches.
It's NPR Sarah McCammon. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can't always get what you want.
The world's biggest producer of seeds for farmers, Monsanto, announced this morning it has agreed to be bought by Bayer, the huge German pharmaceutical company. The deal faces a lot of regulatory hurdles. Critics say it could leave farmers all over the world dependent on just a few companies. NPR's Dan Charles met some of those farmers today in Canada.
The farm show in Woodstock, Ontario is a huge event. 100 acres full of all kinds of farming tools. Monsanto is one of the biggest tents here. Farmer Don Kolkuk is standing outside it, digesting the news that this company's agreed to be swallowed by Bayer.
It's blowing my mind. I just didn't realize that this would ever occur.
Most of the farmers at this show buy products from both companies. Genetically engineered corn and soybean seeds from Monsanto, pesticides from Bayer. In the future, those products might all come from one company. And this is only the latest deal in the seed and pesticide industry. DuPont and Dow are trying to merge. A state-owned chemical company in China is buying Syngenta, which is based in Switzerland. Here's Kelly Sharp, another farmer.
It scares me, the consolidation. That's what scares me, and the control, right? You get so few players in the business, they pretty much dictate their price and everything about it.
Antitrust regulators in several countries will have to sign off on this deal. The combined company would control about 30% of the global seed business. Monsanto and Bayer say together they'll create new and better products. Farmer Roger Kell says that could be true.
On the positive side, they will have access to more technologies, which is what it's all about, really, from their point of view. And that might benefit agriculture as well.
And Quentin Martin, who grows genetically modified corn seed under contract to Monsanto, he wonders whether this deal will change the global debate over GMOs. Like most of the farmers here, he likes biotech crops. He's frustrated that Europe has not embraced them. But Bayer is a German company.
Now that Europe owns this stuff, will they be more inclined to embrace it? And I'm hoping the answer is yes.
The name Monsanto has become so controversial, he says, the best thing would be to bury it. Dan Charles, NPR News, Woodstock, Ontario.
Get ready, Boston drivers. You may soon be sharing the road with a different type of vehicle, one that's driven by the vehicle. Today, city leaders unveiled a plan to test self-driving cars on Boston roadways as part of an initiative with the World Economic Forum. WBUR's Anindya Enwemeka reports.
By the end of this year, you can expect to look into your rearview mirror and see something different on the roadway. Chris Carter, the co-chair of the Mayor's Office of New Urban Mechanics, says the city is preparing for the future of transportation.
Certainly one of the things we're really interested in exploring is potentially vehicles that could be fully electric to sort of address some of the climate change goals that are laid out by the city. And then vehicles that might be in a shared type model that would get at sort of reducing the number of overall vehicles on the street.
But Boston has a number of traffic issues. The city's streets are narrow, heavily congested, and filled with drivers who are rather creative, let's say, about the rules of the road. So how will people react and interact with driverless cars on the roadways? Brian Reamer of the New England Transportation Center at MIT says it's crucial to study this because people will be sharing the roadways with autonomous vehicles, or AVs, for some time.
If the automated vehicles are going to follow traffic law and the rest of us kind of don't, well, the system is not going to flow in the way it needs to, and you're going to see situations where you have minor rear-end collisions. And it's an open question, is it the AV's fault because it didn't go fast enough on the green, or is it the following vehicle's fault because they expected the AV to move like a regular driver?
Reamer says the human element is one major area where there's more work to be done before driverless cars can completely take over. Another is regulation. Carl Yanyama is the CEO of Newtonomy, a Cambridge-based startup that is currently testing self-driving cars in Singapore. He says testing will help determine how the vehicles work in cities like Boston and could help shape better policies.
So we spend a lot of our time focused on solving those technical problems. But if you've got a technical solution and you don't have the regulatory freedom to operate as a business, you don't have much. Having that sort of regulatory framework in place will give companies like mine the confidence to move forward with investment in the city and with planning for eventual rollout of services here.
Boston officials say the new initiative will create policy recommendations on cybersecurity, privacy, and equity. Longer term, the effort will examine ways to prepare residents for a world that will eventually become less driven by people. For 90.9 WBUR and Bostonomics, I'm Zeninjor and Wameka.
There are some 300 athletes from the United States competing this week in the Paralympic Games in Rio. Four of them are Massachusetts natives. We spoke with two of those, a sailor from Marblehead and a runner from Grafton.
My name's Chaz Davis, and I'm part of the Team USA Paralympic track team.
Chaz Davis is 22. 3 years ago, he was a freshman at the University of Hartford, running on the track and cross-country teams. He had a crushing medical setback.
One day in March, I woke up and my right eye, I could really not see too much out of it at all.
It happened so suddenly. Doctors didn't know what was wrong. It wasn't until several months later that doctors determined he had a disorder that attacks the eye's optic nerve and makes it atrophy. Davis soon lost vision in his left eye, too. He was declared legally blind.
Primarily, I see shadows, shapes, and just a whole blur of colors, really. When I first did lose my sight, it was devastating, as, you know, many people would probably realize.
He fell into a deep depression.
I really had no clue where I was going to go. I kind of felt the world was against me and everything was against me, and it would be really hard to move forward.
When Davis was first diagnosed, a doctor told him not to run or exercise at all. It wasn't clear if exertion could further impair what little vision he had left.
And running has always been such a huge part of my life. You know, emotionally, even prior to losing my sight, it has always really been that outlet.
He took the whole summer off. He sat in his bedroom most of the time. He gained 40 pounds. And then he saw a specialist who said that running might help by revitalizing cells. So Davis learned how to run without seeing, how not to fly off the back of a treadmill, how to follow the fuzzy white lines he can just make out on the track. His college teammates rallied around him. He started running on the open road, with them acting as his guides.
So they'll run maybe a step in front of me or side by side where I can see them out of my peripheral vision, because though my entire field of vision is affected, my peripheral vision is most intact. I can have a constant dialogue with them while I run to call out certain obstacles, whether potholes or sticks, those kind of things, so we can maneuver around that.
Chaz Davis started competing again. He became the fastest person on his team, faster than when he had perfect vision.
he isn't the only Bay Stater competing in Rio who had to relearn a sport.
My name is Maureen McKinnon. I'm from Marblehead, Mass., and I am here at the Paralympics for the two-person discipline in sailing.
Maureen McKinnon is 51. She became a paraplegic in 1995.
I was right next to an ocean seawall, and I happened to trip on an unfortunate rope that was in front of me. I did not see over the wall and down 13 feet, sitting in a landing in a sitting position, and breaking my lumbar one and giving me an incomplete spinal cord injury from the waist down.
It didn't stop her from going back to competitive sailing. She tried different boats and found one that was a perfect fit, the Scud 18, which is made for people with disabilities. In 2008, 13 years after she became a paraplegic, McKinnon qualified for the Paralympics in Beijing. She and her sailing partner won gold. Her teammate had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and died not long after the Games. McKinnon's new skipper is a college student from California who became a quadriplegic in a diving accident a few years ago. What does it mean to you specifically to be competing in your second Paralympic Games? And are you looking to other people to kind of take notice to what you're doing?
I would prefer that they take notice of disabled sailing as a whole, because I feel as though the sport is very empowering for people with disabilities. We are able to sail leaving our wheelchairs at the dock, and we're free to go about the ocean as we wish. For me, the honor is really to represent my country for a second time and to hopefully bring home some type of bling around my neck.
Some kind of bling.
Of any color.
Of any color. You're not so choosy, are you?
Well, now that I have a gold, you know, a full set would be nice.
Maureen McKinnon's fellow Bay Stater in Rio, the legally blind runner Chaz Davis, says even if he doesn't medal, competing in the Games will be his personal victory.
I'm really just doing this more so for me, because it's something that I needed to do to get myself back on track and move on with my life and move on from this blindness and not let that define me. You know, because there's a lot more to me than just being blind or having a visual impairment. So really taking that leap of faith got me to the point of making it as far as I have.
So here's the update on the Games. Chaz Davis came in 10th in the 1,500-meter race. That's a personal best for him. Tomorrow morning, he's going to compete in the 5,000-meter race at 9 o'clock Eastern time. Maureen McKinnon will be sailing every day until medals are awarded on Saturday. She and her sailing partner are in sixth place out of 10 pairs in their class.